Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Eastern Bank. Eastern Bank is committed to helping people and businesses prosper, investing over $240 million in local charities since 1994. Eastern Bank. Join us for good. EasternBank.com. Member FDIC.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we'll get your thoughts on what the fall of Liz Cheney will mean. Then if the government is going to spend like Europe on Biden's infrastructure plan, should Americans also be taxed like Europeans? Could a value-added tax be the best way to finance Biden's Build Back Better agenda? Is it the one way to make sure corporations pay their fair share, or will it disproportionately hurt the middle class? MIT economist John Gruber joins us to talk through the VATs, pros, cons, and political viability.
Then it's another look at infrastructure, the Colonial Pipeline cyber attack. Juliet Kayyem joins us to talk us through that and more. Then how can a police officer mistake a taser for a pistol? If police training is part of the problem, can police be taught to defuse confrontations instead of using deadly force? We'll talk to police training veteran Chuck Wexler about the state of police training for the nation's 800,000 officers. That and more ahead on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
Good, good.
So forced to choose between Trump's big lie and Liz Cheney, the House Republicans have chosen the lie. No longer the party of Honest Abe, Trump loyalists are engaging in an amazing exercise of self-deception in order to believe and promote Trump's stolen election propaganda. As I'm sure you know now, House Republicans on a voice vote this morning ousted Liz Cheney from their leadership ranks for refusing to co-opt Trump's election lies. And when she spoke right before the vote, she was booed by her fellow Republicans. Cheney reaffirmed her adherence to the truth last night in a speech from the House floor where she condemned Donald Trump's false election claims.
This is not about policy. This is not about partisanship. This is about our duty as Americans. Remaining silent and ignoring the lie emboldens the liar. I will not participate in that. I will not sit back and watch in silence while others lead our party down a path that abandons the rule of law and joins the former president's crusade to undermine our democracy.
This is a big deal. At least Marjorie and I think it is. We're taking your calls asking you if you agree. Is it a sad day for democracy? Is Trump's hold on his party going to be the undoing of the Republican Party? Will it be the undoing of American politics? What does it say about the state of affairs that Cheney's advocacy for the truth seems heroic? And the flip side is, what happens if the GOP in the House pursuing this big lie line ends up winning and Kevin McCarthy ends up being the Speaker of the House come the beginning of 2023? The number is 877-301-897. You know what I was thinking this morning? You know what the final straw was with Liz Cheney? That she had the audacity to fist bump, meaning say hello,
right,
to the President of the United States as he walked down the aisle to speak to Congress a couple of weeks. This is an embarrassment,
well,
of epic proportions.
You know, I thought this was one of the most, and I'll preface it by saying, as so many other people say, I disagree with her on almost everything, but this was one of the most uplifting, inspiring speeches I've heard
last night
from
on the
anybody
House floor, yeah,
in a long time. And they're such a bunch of cowards. They all walked out. They couldn't even sit in there to listen to her talk. There was like one person, and then maybe there were three people. You couldn't really tell because the camera was just on her. But it was basically an empty chamber. And I think she put it so well. And she's got real guts, too. I love the fact that the people that have stood up to Trump most effectively so far have been two women, Nancy Pelosi and now Liz Cheney.
Well, Mitt Romney is maybe should be in that category,
too. Well, I wouldn't
too.
Exactly call his – I mean, he's done it, too, but it's not with the same kind of
– He's the only person in his own party in American history to vote for the conviction,
right,
of a president.
But he gets much more rattled. He gets much more rattled. She doesn't get rattled. And
I agree with
Pelosi
that. I
get
agree
rattled.
With that. Okay.
So anyway, here's what she said, and I thought this was so important. Today we face a threat America has never seen before. Former president who provoked a violent attack on the Capitol to steal an election has resumed aggressive efforts to convince Americans that the election was stolen. He risks inciting further violence. Millions of Americans have been misled by the former president. They have only heard his words
and not the truth as he continues to undermine our democratic process, sowing seeds of doubt about whether democracy really works at all. It is a big deal. It's almost treasonous what Kevin McCarthy's doing.
Can I make you feel a little better?
What?
Her profile is going to rise about a million percent
Good.
As a result of this ouster. She was just a voice, honest and strong enough to criticize the big lie, so to speak. Now she's almost martyr-like in terms of after having been rejected by her own party members. You know what's also so sad, by the way, speaking of when you mention Pelosi and, well, forget Pelosi for purposes of this discussion, people like Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney, this pathetic story in the New York Times today, over 100 Republicans, including former officials, threatened a split from the GOP. Wow. You know, a couple of former governors, Christy Whitman from Jersey, Tom Ridge from Pennsylvania, a couple of members of Congress. 100 Republicans, well, 70% of rank-and-file Republicans believe the election was stolen, and obviously almost all members of the House of Representatives, far more than 100 Republicans, whether they believe it or not, are willing to say the election was stolen. So we want to know what you think the impact of this vote was this morning. Are we overplaying its significance, or do you agree with us? This is a major, unfortunate moment in our democracy. 877-301-8970. You know what I sort of like, by the way? I love that the person you said before, you know, you got to do the mandatory. I disagree with almost all policies. Mm-hmm. I think it makes it even better. It's not like she's a liberal darling being celebrated by people who are not crazy about Trump. She was 10 times, not 10 times. As I said the other day, she voted with Trump 93% of the time when
right,
he was president.
Right.
Stefanik, the former bipartisan member of Congress, who
correct,
now is all Trumped up, who's apparently going to replace her, at least Stefanik, only voted with Trump in the 70%. So she was as loyal to that president as is humanly possible.
I think what you're hungry for is some people with some guts and some people
amen,
with some principles.
Regardless, I agree.
And people who stand up for what they believe
you're
in.
So
you always
right,
use the great example of Ray Flynn a million years ago when he was the mayor of Boston being opposed on two of the big issues that people in Boston were concerned about. One was taxes and one was abortion. He was on the other side of those issues, but he was a man of principle.
And he was very popular despite being
right,
on the, quote, wrong side.
Right.
He was pro-tax and anti-choice. And he was still very popular because people believed that it was they were acts of principle,
so,
not expediency.
Listening to her was kind of thinking, okay, well, here's one person with principles who's not afraid to speak the truth and a lot of guts. And she seems, like I said, I'm sure this is a very difficult thing for her personally, but she seems undaunted, defiant. She's not going to bend. I just loved every second of it.
877-301-8970. Let's start in Cambridge with Janet. How are you, Janet? Welcome.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Good to talk to you.
You too.
I just wanted to say there's an old expression, hoisted by your own petard.
Yep.
I think that Liz Cheney has been an ultra-conservative for a long time. She's voted with Trump on all kinds of issues that are anti-American and just not good for people. And this is a product of what happened to her, of her own bringing by going along with
Why do you say that? I feel exactly
the opposite. And what was anti-American about her?
Well,
what
she's
are you
a birther.
About?
She was essentially embracing birtherism. I mean, earlier in her career during the Obama thing. I mean,
well,
she could
say that was racist. I'm not sure it's necessarily anti-American.
I would argue it is. But go ahead, Janet. Go ahead.
You can argue with me, but I think that all of the Republican issues that she voted with Trump for 95% of the time, and that she went along with Trump and didn't call him out on all of his other lies. I think that she's complicit in what's happening now and that the Republican Party is in chaos and anyone can get bumped for any reason. There's no rationale.
I got it. But let me just say, Janet, and thank you for your call. They may be in chaos, to use your word. But I think the John Kings and the Chuck Todds will be with us tomorrow would say they're probably favored, despite that chaos, to reclaim the majority in the House of Representatives, which, you know, by the way, everybody's asked on all these cable shows, when does this embrace of the big lie die out? I would argue if the embrace of the big lie allows them to take a majority of the House of Representatives for years to come, it's going to be worse. I mean, what's your negative, deceitful behavior gets positive reinforcement by the voters if that's the outcome, which is a pretty sorry state of affairs.
Here's from Caitlin in Providence. I truly fear the country is going to be held in Trump's grip until Trump dies. The GOP has decided to completely hitch their wagon to a star, will not be free of his dominance until then. And people like McCarthy and Taylor Greene will carry his torch onward. I am exhausted, says
Caitlin. By the way, one of our regular longtime conservative listeners chastened me last week because I made a similar comment saying, as long as Donald Trump is alive, this is going to be with us. And I hope he was kidding when he wrote back to us and said, how come, Jim, you're not sanctioned for saying you wish he was dead? I said nothing of the sort. I was saying what you said a minute ago. As long as he is alive and has the power over his party that he has, nothing is going to change. It was not a death wish for Donald Trump, respectfully.
And you think about this. I mean, when you think about what a con man he is, we had how he dissed John McCain. We had how he dissed a Gold Star family. We had how all these women were up to 25 have said he sexually assaulted them or sexually harassed them or otherwise did some gross thing. We had his own remarks about how he himself goes around grabbing women by the crotch. We had all these incredible things. Mm-hmm. And the one that really kills me is con man wise is the $25 million he had to pay
Trump University
for screwing people out of an education that paid their hard-earned money to try to go get some kind of business sense at Trump University. This is the kind of person that you're wrapping yourself around. I mean, that's what's so bizarre.
Well, this is not an excuse. I've only said this 10,000 times, and I'm not a shrink. This is not a defense at all. He suffers from serious mental illness. Did you read the report last night? He was on the phone with Steve Bannon for hours discussing how he would reclaim the presidency, not in 2024, by overturning the elections from 2020. Is there one sane person, even Trump lovers, even QAnon people, who believe that the election from 2020, forget should be overturned, is going to be overturned? The answer is no. He is a delusional, mentally ill person who has huge influence over weak and sycophantic fellow Republicans.
The thing is, typically, if you have someone who is mentally ill in your family or in your circle of friends, you don't follow them down the primrose path.
Cowards. They're cowards. They're cowards. They may know it. They're cowards. Tom in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Tom.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to remind us that Cheney's father was the one who helped push the weapons of mass destruction delusion data into Iraq, and Obama did nothing about it. I mean, these people get away with murder.
And what do you mean, Obama? What do you mean Obama did nothing about it? He should have had the Justice Department indict Vice President Cheney.
Yes, I think the people who do something that egregious need to be pulled in. I mean, U.S.
With all due respect, Tom, this is not about her father. And by the way, I have plenty of bad things to say, including about the weapons of mass destruction issue that you do. This is about her. And so respectfully, we appreciate your opinion, but we'll talk about Vice President Cheney on another day. I don't think she should be. If she embraces him, it's one thing. If not, the sins of the father, I don't think, get visited on the kid. In any case, 877-301-8970. And by the way, longtime listeners of the show know that Marjorie and I actually have a disagreement about whether or not the WMD decision by his boss, President Bush, was an intentional misrepresentation or just a horrible and deadly mistake. I'm on the intentional side with Tom there. Ann in Shrewsbury, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Ann.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Okay, so we're living in a Robert Ludlum novel and watching the takeover of the United States government by these people. You know, Trump, the man himself, I agree with you, has a diagnosable illness. But he's just a symptom of what's happening in this country.
Meaning?
And I think, because he's unleashed what our neighbors are thinking. I mean,
that's true.
I had a Black Lives Matter sign in my yard that somebody keeps taking down, like driving by my house and taking it down repeatedly to the point where I'm putting a spotlight and nails. It's crazy. So, I think it's a call to the rest of us who who, you know, whatever your, this is not politics anymore. I really believe this is taking care of, you know, our human rights, because I can't imagine being a person of color or in the LGBTQ community right now and feeling like what's coming. This is really a call for us, you know, us to, as exhausted as we are, you got to fight. The fight didn't even, you know, day after election, I woke up and I thought, all right, I'm going to not watch the news today. But now I'm like, I got to be back on it. Because this, what happened today is huge, I think, with Liz Cheney.
I think we think it's huge, too. And thank you kindly for your phone call, 877-301-8970. I know we've said this before. I think it was around January 6th most recently. If this were happening in another Western democracy, that a former leader held total sway over the elected members of his party, surrounding a lie, and not a lie, by the way, where some fair-minded people might disagree as to whether that was truthful right. or not, but something where what would we be saying about
well,
that country?
Say,
if it was the UK or Germany
well,
we
say,
France?
What happened to them? They turned into Russia. What happened to them? They turned into China. What's happened to them? They turned into North Korea. I mean, that, where the propaganda is so strong
exactly.
and that people get sucked into it. Here's one of our conservative listeners, Art from West Bridgewater.
Oh, Art was actually the one who wrote, I like Art a lot, actually. Art is the guy that wrote, I think, criticizing me for what I was not saying about Donald Trump's life. But go ahead.
Well, here's what he's saying about Liz Cheney.
Yep.
Why do you hate small D democracy so much? The Republicans cynically dumped Cheney because they made the calculation that their small R voters will be turned off by fighting with Trump and they'll lose any path to retaking the House and Senate. They're doing what they believe their voters want. They may be right or wrong. The courage you seek speaking loudly against Trump to the near exclusion of all our considerations is for the GOP to take a stance that will make them as irrelevant as the mass GOP. Do you want to respond?
No, if they want to dump a member of their leadership team for political reasons that are not associated with a lie that is so corrosive and toxic, Art, I am totally fine with that. They can decide their own things. That's not why she's gone. She's gone because she had the temerity to greet the president of the United States, the legitimate president of the United States, when he walked down the aisle when speaking to Congress the other night, the Democratic president of the United States, and because she has the you know, it's horrible to even say courage because she speaks the truth about the big lie. That's the problem. It's
but
the basis for the expulsion, not the expulsion itself.
And here's the thing I would say to Art. This is a huge big deal because look at what's happening all around the country. On the basis of this big lie, we're having legislatures, Republican legislatures all around the country, rewrite voting
Arizona
laws.
Just yesterday, the governor signed their law.
Yeah, what do we have to, like 20 some?
I don't know what the number is.
It's a lot. It's a lot of states rewriting the election laws based on a lie, saying that we have to make it tougher to vote based on a lie. Basically,
right.
You know, this is a huge big deal. Now you say to yourself that a lot of people are suing. You know, the ACLU is suing the NAACP. Mm-hmm. It's the League of Women Voters is suing
that radical organization.
Yeah, they're a bunch. They're really a bunch of radical nuts in the League of Women Voters. I'm being sarcastic, of course. They're suing, and at some point, some of this is going to get to the Supreme Court. I don't know what the Supreme Court will do, and I don't know if they'll get there in time.
About what? Oh, the individual restrictions, you mean?
Well, about basically shutting down voting based on a lie.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court has already spoken on the big lie that underpins this whole thing.
But I'm hoping, that based on John Roberts' ridiculous decision before, that he's realized he was—
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't— you
By
wouldn't,
the way, you even if John Roberts, in your opinion, gets religion or has an epiphany— There are five other people on the conservative side
That's
of the bench.
Right. But I'm not so sure.
Three of whom were picked by Donald Trump,
I'm not so sure Kavanaugh, after his baptism by fire, is going to wind up being as conservative as we think he is. I just don't. Anyway, I have no inside information. It's just a gut feeling. Mike in the car, you're next. Hi Mike.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I take slight issue with something Jim said earlier, which is that that any rational person in Congress believes that it was a big lie and that it was a huge theft. I think it's simply inertia and sort of the fear of Trump crushing them as he did with so many people when he still had Twitter, when he still had Facebook. So I think maybe we're focusing the lens a little too closely, and at least that's my hope, that once they discover he's much more of a paper tiger than he's been in the past, that, you know, some sanity will will emerge.
And well, but Mike, why didn't they appreciate? And by the way, I didn't. I tend to agree with you. I'm not saying they all believe it. They all act like they believe it is what I really meant to say. Why wasn't his paper tigerdom last November enough? Republicans lost the House. They lost the Senate because Donald Trump got involved in the two Georgia elections that amazingly went Democratic, and he also lost the presidency. I mean, that to me is the definition of a paper tiger, yet they're still there. So why do you think another round of paper tigerdom is going to cause them to sour on the guy?
Well, that's what I'm saying, is that we're still, you know, it's still inertia. It hasn't caught up with him yet.
I see. Maybe.
Yeah, again, 80 million people voted, you know, for Biden and not for Trump, so the lie didn't work.
Well, 70 million, but I would argue that even though you're right, obviously Biden prevailed, the fact that 70 million voted for his reelection and that 70% of Republicans, as you know, continue to tell pollsters, whether they believe it or not, that they do believe that the election was stolen, to me is, I don't know if I can wait long enough for the inertia to disappear, I guess, Mike. But you may be right in terms of your analysis. Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay, we're talking about Liz Cheney's defense of the truth and how it's provoked her party to turn on her. The conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
To Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Liz Cheney in the aftermath of January 6th, challenging her fellow Republicans to turn away from Trump. Instead, this morning, they turned on her. She's gone as the number three member of the leadership, the Republicans in the House, and so much for their antipathy towards cancel culture. We're taking your calls asking, really, are you concerned about the party of Lincoln mutating into, I don't know, the party of lies, 877-301-8970. Before we get back to the calls, I just remember the first caller today with whom we disagreed, but nevertheless, we're glad to hear from her, said that Cheney was being hoisted her own petard. Yeah, I meant to say, what is a petard? I've been using that expression for my whole life. What is a petard?
I don't know. Something you can hoist somebody on.
So you really don't know either?
I have no idea.
I have to look it up. Okay.
Yeah, look it up, Jim. Look it up.
Want to take a call?
Yes, let's take a call. Ann in Lincoln, thank you for calling.
Hi, Ann.
Yes. Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I was delighted to hear Liz Cheney actually use the phrase that Trump was the one who was trying to steal the election in her speech yesterday.
Yeah.
This is what the big lie is all about, but nobody ever really says it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one, and his party, they're the ones trying to steal the election and destroy democracy. My other point is I'm the daughter of a World War II veteran who spent 2 years of his young life fighting fascism and the Nazis over in Europe. And it really affected him for the rest of his life. And I can't imagine how people who have relatives who served in that war and lived through that, you know, their families and everything, can not recognize what's happening here. You know, this is fascism 2.0. And everybody ought to watch the PBS show Rise of the Nazis that's been playing again recently on TV. But, you know, this is very scary stuff. This is about democracy, and we need to really pay attention. It's not over when Biden won.
You know, Ann, but you know, who also,
battle.
A surprising source, made a wonderful film about fascism.
Rick Steves.
Rick Steves,
it's great.
Exactly. You should check it out. It really is a wonderful piece by our buddy, the travel guy. And thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
Here's from BJ in Brighton. Not to be an alarmist like Jim, but something Chuck Todd said to you guys last week stuck with me. What happens if the Republican Party does take the House
exactly.
in the midterms? Would they refuse to certify a 2024 Democratic presidential win?
Well, you know, I had the exact same reaction to what Chuck said the other day, which was pretty dramatic. The second thing is, why should we assume that they're not going to challenge any? If this works, it, to the point where, as Chuck said and the emailer said, that they're able to claim the House majority come November of next year, then why wouldn't they keep doing the same thing? I mean, don't you repeat that which works for you? So I, you know, as worried as I am about today, I have not heard anybody convince me that they understand where this all ends. I don't get it.
Okay, let's get a little bit more of Liz Cheney here. Good. Here she is this morning talking to a reporter outside the Capitol building after the vote.
I do not. I think that it is an indication of where the Republican Party is, and I think that the party is in a place that we've got to bring it back from, and we've got to get back to a position where we are a party that can fight for conservative principles, that can fight for substance. We cannot be dragged backward by the very dangerous lies of a former president.
You know what I love? She's just fearless.
Well, it's fearless. As I was just saying that, does she appear on CNN or MSNBC?
In terms of fearless? I don't know.
Why doesn't she?
I don't know.
I mean, why shouldn't she answer questions from anybody if she's as courageous
well,
as we all say
I have
she
no
is.
Idea if she's been asked. I have
I've
no
never
idea
seen
if
her
she's
on.
Been on. I don't
she,
know.
Actually, Aiden tells us she has been on MSNBC, forget that.
Well, I don't think she has any problem at answering questions. She's obviously very smart and very tough, and I just admire that because we see it so seldom in our elected leaders. Frank from Woonsocket, thank you for calling.
Welcome, Frank.
Hey, good morning, Jamie Marjorie.
Hi.
I would certainly agree with you. She's definitely tough, and you know, it's unfortunate what's happening with her. And I'm kind of hoping that this is, you know, Senator Cheney's Stacey Abrams moment, you know, where she can get some traction.
Yeah.
Maybe she leaves the Republican Party and becomes an independent, you know. So hopefully some good things happen out of this.
Well, I mean, the one thing that will clearly happen, Frank, as I said to Marjorie earlier on, her profile, if anything, is going to rise as a result of this ouster. Obviously, it's been pretty high the last few weeks. But when your members of your same party overwhelmingly vote to oust you from a leadership position and, as I said before, reportedly boo you in the caucus when you speak prior to the vote, I would say that does nothing but elevate her profile. We'll see what happens. Frank, thank you for the call.
What? And look at who remains in good standing. She did lose her committee seat, but that lunatic, Marjorie Taylor Greene, talking
point.
About Jewish space lasers, whatever she was talking about, QAnon, you know, Hillary Clinton is running a sex ring. I mean, it's just crazy. This guy, Jim Jordan, I have to look at him every single day. The scandal at Ohio State University where all these wrestlers talk about how he knew about this other coach sexually abusing wrestlers. What did he do about it?
Took his jacket off, which he's
yeah.
had it off for
so he's up
the last
there
10 years.
Giving everybody speeches. And one of the wrestler's brothers, remember that story about how one of the wrestler's brothers said Jim Jordan called him on the phone begging him not to reveal, not to implicate him in this scandal?
Well, you know, Marjorie, even though you focus on one individual member of Congress from one district in Ohio,
because every
Jordan,
time I turn on the TV,
well,
there
I know,
he is.
But there was a guy who actually won a higher office. After, as you say, having been credibly accused of sexual misconduct, which is a euphemism, what, 25 times, 24 times?
Yep.
So, I mean, we're a very forgiving nation.
Well,
I guess.
All the women were lying, Jim.
Apparently
that is
they
what,
were.
That's what the president, the creator of the big lie, says. They were all lying. Let's go to Adam in Worcester. Hi, Adam.
Hello, Adam.
Hey, nice to talk to you guys. So I guess the thing I've been thinking most about this whole Liz Cheney thing is that it's so crazy because it's not even an ideological discussion. It's not a political discussion. It's just demonstrably false that this deal didn't happen, and people just still cling to it. And it seems like the Republican Party is weaponizing ignorance so they can use it to keep people like feeling self-righteous about their political beliefs and keep them invested.
I think that is a perfect call, and I wish I had said those exact same words. They're not just weaponizing in terms of ousting her, as Marjorie said. They're weaponizing in terms of all these voter restrictions in these states, most recently Arizona the other day, all premised upon the notion that the election was fraudulent, that it was stolen, neither of which is true. Adam, that was a perfect summary and, of where we are.
Art just emailed back, said they're only doing things, getting rid of things that, they put in there, especially for the pandemic. It's not true. I mean, Florida's been voting by mail for years, and they're trying to restrict voting by mail.
Well, Arizona purged voter rolls in terms of who can do or get a mail ballot, that sort of thing. What's the connection?
And you know what else I love to
last election there?
When you hear people say, some of these Republicans say, well, there's a lot of, you know, that we have a lot of evidence of irregularities. Mr. Pillow is always arguing that too. Mm. The Pillow guy running around. And they say, well, what evidence? And then they never seem to be able to give you, you know, the they'll talk about thousands of people, dead people voting. Well, who were they? Where was that? What are the names of the dead people? Exactly. I mean, they just keep giving these blanket statements and get away with it. It's just bizarre. And now they're doing this bizarre recount out in Arizona. One of the guys was at the rally on January 6th, not letting people in there to supervise anything. It's almost...
Well, can we repeat? We've said this on the show three times, so apologies for people heard all the time. What they're looking for, the leader of the effort, is looking for bamboo. Is it threads? I'm not sure what the noun is.
I don't know.
Bamboo in the ballots, because they contend, those who are leading the, quote, audit, that 40,000 votes were cast, yeah. I think, from China, obviously illegally, and that's what swung the election. Didn't Biden just win that by 11, I think 10 or 11,000? By the way, I made a mistake a minute ago when I said that she had been on MSNBC. I was wrong. She was on NBC with Savannah Guthrie. So that's where – which is good, by the way.
Savannah
which
Guthrie.
Is where Liz
– she's the reporter
appeared.
That got Trump really going, remember?
She was great. She was terrific
great.
At that
forum. She didn't let him get away with anything.
We only have time for one more.
Okay. John from Westwood. Thank you for calling.
Hi, John. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. My comment was about a friend of mine who is incredibly Republican. And, you know, when the insurrection happened, she said, we are strong people. She thinks masks are communism. And but she's a high school friend of mine. So I kind of just let it roll off my back.
Mm-hmm.
But the other day I messaged her on Instagram and I said, I can't believe what's happening with Liz Cheney and the leadership and, you know, everything that's happening in Arizona. And her response to that was, who is Liz Cheney?
Oh my
and I
God.
Couldn't even believe that, you know, you're such a strong Republican and you don't even know what's going on in your party. And I just thought to myself, I didn't respond. And I just thought, at what point are there social like repercussions for this type of, you know, political you know, I don't know what the word is, but it just feels like, you know, can I not be friends with these people anymore? Like, usually I say, oh, they're my friends. I know they're good people. But I'm starting to get a little patriotic about what's going on. And, you know, you don't even know, like, you know, people are what's going on. For me, it's just my mood's changing a little bit. And I'm starting to feel like I have to sort of shut them out and let them know that, you know, this isn't okay. And you're starting to mess with the fabric of America in a very unique way that I don't think we've seen before.
You know, John, the reason I loved your call beyond the content, it was a great story you told, too, is it sounds like your head is ready to pop off, which is how I feel almost every waking hour about the state of affairs. John, that was a great one, too. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us.
To quote Liz Cheney, the person we're talking about today, we are facing a threat America has never seen before. And that's what she's talking about, this big lie perpetuated by a big liar and bought by apparently 70 million people and 70% of the Republican Party. I mean, it's really scary, but I'll shut up now because I've talked enough. Okay. It is. You know, the only thing about getting older is I think, well, I'll be 6 feet under by the time the worst of this happens. But, you know, what about my kids and my future grandchildren?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
I do know.
This is the United States of America. We're like Russia and communist China here. Anyway, up next.
Don't you wish you could say what that guy's friend said? Who's Liz Cheney? I mean, that would make things a lot easier.
Could a value-added tax be the best way to pay for Biden's Build Back a Better agenda? MIT economist Jonathan Gruber is going to school us on value-added taxes. Up next, keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Mardrigan. And if President Biden's Build Back Better agenda will put America on track with other industrial nations when it comes to improving our transportation system, childcare, and the fight against climate change, should the U.S. government also consider paying for this agenda the same way other industrial nations do, using a value-added tax? Join us online to talk through what the pros and cons of a value-added tax are and what it is, and thank God I don't have to explain it, not to mention its political viability or lack of same, is Jonathan Gruber. John is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT. He was instrumental in creating both the Massachusetts Healthcare Reform and the Affordable Care Act. His latest book is Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Welcome, Professor Gruber. Good to talk to you, John.
Good to be here.
Yeah, we need a professor because I am way out of my comfort zone with this one, John Gruber. So first begin by telling us what, please, is a value-added tax?
Well, I'm going to start before that because I think you can understand a value-added tax without stepping back and understanding how we raise taxes and how different we are from the rest of the world.
Go right ahead.
But basically, in the U.S., we get most of our tax revenue from taxing people's income through the income tax or their payroll through what you see in your payroll form as FICA or Medicare taxes. That's where we get most of our revenues from. We get about 15% of our tax revenues from taxing consumption. That's the sales tax you pay, the 6.25% we pay here in Massachusetts, or things like the excise tax on cigarettes or alcohol. In Europe, they get more than twice the share of their revenues from consumption taxes. About a third of revenues in Europe, about twice the U.S. level, are raised by taxing consumption. So why do different countries, why do they tax consumption more than we do? Okay, so let's just talk about taxing consumption versus taxing income. Before we get into what a value-added tax is, a value-added tax is just a kind of consumption tax. It's like a sales tax, but with a different name. So let's step back and ask, well, why should we tax consumption versus income? Okay, and we can go all the way back to Thomas Hobbes. You remember him, life is nasty, brutish, and short, Thomas Hobbes.
Still is.
And Thomas Hobbes said, Thomas Hobbes in 1716-whatever made the case for the consumption tax. And he said it is fair to tax people on what they extract from the economy, as roughly measured by the consumption, than to tax them what they produce for the economy, as roughly measured by their income. So that's kind of a central position if you think about it. So the basically idea of consumption tax is, look, income is what you produce, consumption is what you extract. Why do we tax people on what they produce rather than what they extract? So that's kind of the argument in a nutshell. Now, economics terms, the way to put this is that the income tax deters savings. Because when you save on the income tax, you get taxed essentially twice. You get taxed on your income as you earn it, and then you get taxed again on your interest as you earn it. Whereas a consumption tax just taxes you once when you spend your money.
Well, except so except your interest as you earn it is additional income. It's not the prior
income
that's already been taxed.
And you know I'm for taxing that. We've discussed that before. But the argument that economists would make, and the reason the majority of economists, if you polled them, would support a consumption tax over an income tax, is that a consumption tax would encourage more savings. Because people would only be taxed when they consume things, therefore would encourage savings.
Well, except
so the majority of economists would prefer a consumption tax because it would tax, because it would allow, because it would encourage savings by taxing only when people consume things, not when they earn money.
I want to discuss in a few minutes the negative side of a consumption tax.
Oh, we're going to get there.
I know that, but I don't think we can go any further without. When you said it's like a sales tax, it's like a sales tax, but not like a sales tax. I mean, we're used to a sales tax in this country where the final product is bought by us, assuming it's subject to a tax. We pay a tax in that one spot, and that's it.
Right.
Without giving people a total headache, explain how a value-added tax operates differently, if you can, John.
Sure. So let's explain how it works, okay? A value-added tax is simply what we call a cascading sales tax. It's a sales tax, but instead of paying it all at the end when the consumer buys the good, you pay it at each point of the production process. Best way to see this is through an example. This is the way I teach it. It's the best way to see it. Let's say you have a table that sells for $100 at a retailer. The way the U.S. sales tax would work is you would pay sales tax on $100. The way a value-added tax would work is value-added tax we pay to three different points. First, the logger who cuts down the wood and sells it for $25. We would say he has added $25 in value because he started with nothing and produced the wood. So he is taxed on $25. The manufacturer then sells, then takes the wood, makes the table, and sells it to a retailer for $75. We say the $50, which is the difference between what the manufacturer sold it for and what they paid for the wood, is their value added. So the value added by the manufacturer is the difference between what they pay for their inputs, which is the wood, and what they sell to the retailer for. So they'd be taxed on $50. The retailer then sells it for $100. They paid $75 to the manufacturer. They sold it for $100. So they have $25 in value added, and they're taxed on that. At the end of the day, $100 is taxed, just like in the U.S. The difference is it's not taxed all at the end. It's taxed along the way.
And what is
based
it, why
on
is
how
that?
Much value each,
what, why is taxing along the way as value is added a preferable route to the 170-some countries that have a value-added tax?
It's a preferable route for two reasons. Okay, the more important reason is it's a great way to fight cheating. Okay, this if we were going to have a if we were going to replace the income tax with a consumption tax in America, we would need to have a sales tax in the order of 25% to 30%. Can you imagine the black market in a world where every time you go to buy a good from a formal store, you pay 30% more, but every time you buy it back of a guy's truck, you don't? Okay? The value-added tax fights that because it's self-enforcing. If the retailer tries to cheat and say, oh, no, I didn't add much value, then they're implying the manufacturer added more value. So in other words, what the more the manufacturer pays in tax, the less the retailer does. So if the retailer tries to cheat by paying less in tax, the government's going to make the manufacturer pay more in tax. And the manufacturer say, no way. I sold that to that guy for $75. Don't let him tell you he paid $90 for it, so he only owes you $10 in value added. Because if he says that, you're going to hit me with a higher tax. It becomes self-enforcing because at every level, if you cheat, you hurt the guy below you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy below you enforces and makes sure you pay what you truly, your true value added. So it reduces cheating because at the end of the day, the guy at the back of the truck, he still has to get it from the manufacturer. So he is only he's not going to be able to save that much money by selling the back of the truck as opposed to selling out of the store.
Okay. Now, John Gruber, Veronique just emailed and said that she does not like this tax. She calls it the most fair of all because whether you earn $10,000 a year or $100,000 a year, you're going to pay the same extra on every product. She argues it's unfairly penalizes low and medium income earners. And that's correct, isn't it?
Well, that now we get to the con. So, okay, so there's three things to cover. There's why economists like consumption taxes, and that's because it promotes savings. There's then Jim changed the order, but I dove into how that tax works, and I'm sure I wasn't clear enough on that, so we can come back to that. But to come back to the question, let's talk about the con of consumption taxes. It's incredibly unfair to the poor. And it's unfair. Remember, imagine a simple world where the rich and the poor all saved the same and consumed the same share of their income. Then it would be equally fair to come to that question. The person with $10,000, they would consume, let's say everybody consumed 50% of their income. Then the person with $10,000 would pay the tax on $5,000. The person with $100,000 would pay tax on $50,000 and be totally fair. The difference is the rich save more than the poor. Though the bottom 20% of Americans save only 3% of their income over their lifetime.
Yeah.
The top 20% of Americans save 25% of their income over their lifetime. So the problem, and this is what she's getting at with her question, the problem with the consumption tax is unfair. Because it would basically, since the rich save more, it would levy the poor would pay a higher share of their income in taxes than would the rich.
You know, John, one of the things that makes the income tax fairer, unlike in Massachusetts where we have a flat tax, where somebody whose name I can't recall attempted to change the Constitution in the 1990s and lost the campaign by a mere 71-29% with the public. The graduated income tax, which exists in most states in the federal government, obviously the higher rate, the more income you have, attempts to obviously to be a more progressive tax. When Andrew Yang was talking about paying for his universal basic income with a value added tax, he talked about, I'm making up a number, that the basic value-added tax rate would be 10%. And again, he didn't say that. I don't know what his number was. I'm just picking it. But on luxury items, the value-added tax rate would be at a higher rate. Would that offset some of the regressivity of a value-added tax in general, or it doesn't do it to nearly the effect that graduated income tax rates do?
So two answers, Jim. One is it doesn't do it to nearly the effect. It's just because rich people still spend a ton of their income on stuff that isn't luxury.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the other point is this is why I will never support Andrew Yang. Because Andrew Yang, here's what his platform came down to. Let's give a basic income to everyone financed by a tax that's paid for by the poor.
Yeah.
It's the stupidest idea. I don't understand why Andrew Yang gets credit for being this intellectual genius when, in fact, his idea is to basically give you and me a flat income paid for by a tax that we avoid because we're savers.
Mm-hmm.
That's nuts. Okay, and that's why the consumption tax – now, let's not forget the pro. I mean, the pro is the consumption tax would promote savings in the U.S., which you do too little of. But the reason I'm not a fan is I think the con is larger, which is that basically it's unfair.
So why, if we're the only nation out of something called 168 countries and something called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development,
right.
Every single nation in that, 168 or whatever it is, have a value-added tax. The United States is the one holdout. In light of the fact that so many of those countries, I can't name a number, are far more progressive, much more social democracies than we are, if the value-added tax is as regressive as you say it is, and I totally agree with you, by the way, then why have they chosen that as their primary, at least, or a primary vehicle for raising revenue from their citizenry?
Because the Europeans have – remember – you have to think about what's done with the taxes. And the Europeans have a very different model. They raise a lot more in taxes, some of which are actually less fair than the income tax. Mm-hmm. Like, they still have big income taxes, don't forget. They just have this value tax. But then they spend the money progressively to help the poor. So if you look at the net of tax and spending, they're much fairer to the poor than the U.S. is. But to raise the amount of money they need to guarantee a minimum – they can't raise it all through the income tax. They have a consumption tax, too. So a legitimate question is, would the people of Europe be better off with a somewhat less generous welfare state and a lower consumption tax? That's an interesting question to ask. But clearly the choice Europe's made is they're willing to do some unfair taxation to do extra fair spending.
We're talking to John Gruber, MIT economist, about the value-added tax. John, you mentioned that lots of economists like the value-added tax because it promotes savings and also fights cheating. But is there any reason to think that this has any reality, that it could ever come to pass?
In the U.S., you mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's there's a great saying about this. I don't know who it's due to, but the saying is that liberals should love the value-added tax because it's a great way to raise money. Conservatives should love the value-added tax because it's unfair to poor people. And yet each side realizes the other side's position and doesn't support it. So basically liberals hate it because it's unfair. Republicans hate it because it's going to lead the government to raise more money. So basically, no, it's not politically tenable in any near term. I think if we're going to see more taxes on consumption in the U.S., they'll be more targeted, like taxes on carbon or taxes. Look, I think one of the, you know, and my kids kill me for saying this, but alcohol is just way too cheap. I mean, way too cheap compared to many other types of goods we consume. And it's way too cheap compared to the damage that alcohol does to our society. And we should have much higher taxes on alcohol. So I think that we can – so I think what we'll see in the U.S., I don't think we're going to see a broad-based consumption tax in the U.S. at any time in my lifetime.
You know,
but
what
I do think we could see more targeted consumption tax.
You know, in this little primer on value-added tax, it talks about how what happens with tourists or people that are not citizens of a country. Like if you went to visit Ireland, which apparently has a value-added tax of 23% for out-of-country consumers, you can claim a refund. Did you even know about this? This is seems so obscure.
Yeah, so basically there's a whole bunch of – I have not gotten into a ton of the details of value-added tax. There's a whole bunch of complications around how you treat exports. Any of people who've bought anything expensive abroad, like I bought a piece of jewelry for my wife in Italy, you can get a form where you can get a rebate on the value-added tax you paid on that jewelry. There's a whole bunch of extra complications. It's sort of funny because one point advocates of value-added tax will make is that it's simpler because you just pay in consumption. It's not this complicated tax form. But in fact, it ends up – every kind of tax ends up being super complicated. You've got these rebates. You've got different rates on different goods. It ends up being pretty complicated.
You know, we only have a minute left. And let me – when you mention expanding consumption taxes, not only did I get crushed in my effort to change the state constitution.
It was a valiant effort, though,
well,
Jim.
I only, as I say, lost 71 to 29. I also had a ballot question, John, that would expand the state sales tax to services. It actually – I cut a deal. I and the people on my campaign cut a deal with Governor Weld and others to put it in place, and then it was repealed by the Democratic leaders, Bill Bulger and Charlie Flaherty. And we'll leave you with this, and maybe we can talk about this in the future. We have this odd, totally unfair situation in terms of the sales tax in Massachusetts. If you buy a lawnmower, Marjorie, are you – do you pay a sales tax? In Massachusetts?
Jim, I have no idea.
The answer is yes.
Oh, okay.
If you
Thank
hire
you.
Someone to mow your lawn, do you pay a sales tax in Massachusetts?
The answer
must be no. The answer is no. So maybe we can address that inequity about expanding the sales tax in places like Massachusetts to services to level the playing field, John, one of the next times you give us a tutorial. Fair enough?
Fair enough. And anytime. Always happy to do tutorials.
Hey, we love these. We really learn. You know, I used to run a tax reform organization. I could never explain the value-added tax, and I sort of feel like now I could. John Gruber, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
I really concentrated trying to read these stories, and I think I got a little bit out of them. Jim.
Well, I got a lot out of them and a lot out of John, too. It's great.
Yeah, well, John is the great professor because that's why he can teach, right? Because he can explain
all
this stuff. Anyway, Jonathan Gruber joins us regularly. He's the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT, instrumental in creating both the Massachusetts healthcare reform and the Affordable Care Act. His latest book, Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Coming up, our national security expert Juliet Kayyem is here to talk through the Colonial Pipeline cyber attacks. How did it happen? What about gas? And what are the long-term consequences? She's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, when it comes to vaccinating children, it's not as much about saving them as it is about saving society. If kids aren't vaccinated, we might not be able to stomp out coronavirus. Now, the Pfizer vaccine for children ages 12 to 15 has been granted emergency use authorization. It's up to parents to decide if their kids should get it. We'll ask medical ethicist Art Kaplan about what it'll take to win parents over and if a mandate could be key to getting us on the other side of the pandemic.
On January 6th, we saw how dangerous misinformation can be when people are actually inspired to take action. Why misinformation is proliferating is something Brendan Nyhan has been tracking. His latest research finds that social and psychological forces combine to make the sharing and believing of misinformation a rampant problem with no easy solution. His explanation and more coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. I am Marjorie Yeagan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there. You know, Mackenzie, our coworker, was monitoring Governor Baker's press conference earlier, about an hour ago. We should have mentioned this. One particularly interesting – well, two interesting things. One is Henry just said a couple of seconds ago, there were zero deaths yesterday, first time since June in Massachusetts.
Great.
But this is quite interesting. What Governor Baker said this morning is they're launching this employer vaccination program – And one of the facets of it is that companies can request mobile vaccine clinics to come to the office. More details to follow. I think that's terrific. You know, sort of like we were discussing with Michael Curry yesterday, is take the vaccines to where the people are. We were talking about it in the context of vaccine equity, but in terms of the concept of vaccine expansion, grabbing as many people as possible.
That's access.
A terrific idea. Yeah.
And that was one of his big themes. People are having difficulty accessing.
Also, it's probably a lot harder to turn it down when it's at your workplace and all your coworkers are vaccinated. In any case.
Staring at you. Yeah, they're staring at
you. Exactly. Glaring at you, I believe, is the verb you were talking about. Joining us on the line to go over the latest national security headlines is Juliette Kayyem. Juliette is a former assistant secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. She is the faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And an analyst for CNN. Hello there, Juliette Kayyem. How are you?
Good to see you both. I mean, see you through Zoom, hopefully soon.
I know.
We're together.
We will be.
So that's so exciting. I'm so excited.
Well, I'm excited about talking to you because this we see the lines of all these people in these massive long lines for gas, and they're running out of gas, and the cyber attack on this massive pipeline. Give us the latest.
So the attack looks or not looks like is a ransomware attack where an entity gets into a system, this one based in Russia, and with every expectation that they would not get into trouble for doing this. So whether Putin directed it or just simply likes disrupting U.S. critical infrastructure is an irrelevant distinction. That hack essentially required the company to go offline simply to purge, that's a nice way of putting it, to purge their wires from whatever these hackers had access to. I think they don't know at this stage. So the response was appropriate. And so we've got a couple days. I think people are panicking too soon, although understandable, because if this does go on, there will be increased price or greater price increases in particular areas, including New England might be impacted. So what's going on right now is simply what the federal government knows how to do. The private sector owns our critical infrastructure. It was up to Colonial to protect its networks. It did not. And so if I sound annoyed, it's because this was not a sophisticated hack. This was something that Colonial ought to have been prepared for. The FBI had been warning of it for months. And so we're now in the consequence management stage of this, which is, you know, how many resources do we have? How do we make sure that the system stays online? How do we divert to other pipelines or to trucks, which is what you're starting to see? And Colonial says that it should be back up online by the end of the week. So I think we're okay in quotation marks if that holds. So that's basically where we are. But I mean, look, you know, 45% of the Northeast energy delivery system resides in a single company. That means no redundancies. That means we don't have a lot of give. Thank God it's not winter. And there's a lot of lessons learned here.
Well, okay, two things. I hope the Colonial is the outlier in terms of their alleged negligence. They're not the outlier. Okay, I know a lot of people don't like government regulations, but it does seem to me as something as crucial as important as this, there should be more safeguards. Do we need that?
Yes. And so one of the challenges here, I've been sort of reflecting on it, and I'll probably have more later. But I think one of the challenges here is this bifurcation between cybersecurity and physical security. We have much more regulations on physical security than we do in cybersecurity, mostly because the private sector doesn't like regulations over their networks and has come to understand there have to be regulations over their pipes and bridges and dams and things like that. I think that bifurcation we're showing is just not relevant in today's age. I mean, a cyber attack is an attack, right? I mean, yes, in the olden days, if an enemy wanted to get us, they would bomb our bridges and bomb our dams and they would disrupt critical infrastructure. I don't see the difference here. It may be that our response has to be different because it's just a different kind of attack. So I think that's a huge issue that we have to address. And the second is, until then, we are dependent on the private sector. And I've in the various press conferences by the White House, they've made it clear that to other companies, you better get your act together. I don't know what's in store, but this is just, you know, the benefit of being a big company that controls critical infrastructure is you get to be rich and do interesting things. But there's an obligation or responsibility, which is your networks are as valuable now to an enemy as the pipes and the dam and the bridge.
You know, I don't mean to be an alarmist. Last week, we were an alarmist about the Chinese rocket. We'll get to that in a couple of minutes. But, you know, that's like a one and, well, hopefully a one and done kind of thing.
No,
okay,
more
fine.
To come.
We'll get to that
There's
in a minute.
10 more.
Okay, fine. We'll get to that in a minute. I shouldn't have brought it up. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, so this is one pipeline, obviously the most important in this part of the country. There was the SolarWinds thing, what, a couple of months ago that allegedly still hasn't been expelled from all the government computers. There's biological warfare kind of thing. Well, actually, let me get focused. This all scares me. If they can do this to one pipeline, albeit the most important one, why can't they simultaneously do it to every pipeline and every energy source in the dead of winter in the United States?
They could. And so that's the challenge. We are probably lurking in their systems and they're lurking in ours. And, you know, part of it is just the threat of disruption. It can be as scary as disruption. Now, do we counterattack in the same way? Time will tell. I mean, there's going to be covert actions in response to this. I can't say enough what a big deal this is. I know we're not experiencing it
said that. That's exactly the point I was trying to make.
Shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, I tend not to get too nervous about things. This one's a big deal. I think part of it is just the boldness of going after Colonial. I'm sure most people listening had never heard of the company, but people
I
like me, these kinds of entities and the ones that control so much distribution in our supply chain are a big deal. And they're sophisticated. I don't mean to say, you know, that they didn't take security seriously, but they obviously didn't take a certain type of security seriously, which is a potential ransomware attack. This is no joke. So put it a different way. If it were February, and this was going to last longer than say a week, let's say it wasn't a ransomware attack, but it was a disruption of service attack that was successful. This would be very bad. And so it does make me nervous. And we're sort of in a mutually assured destruction positioning with China and Russia, which is North Korea, we are likely in their system. So that's why we don't play this game. But this group acted boldly and whatever President Biden says about we can't attribute it to Russia, nothing happens in Russia without the passive or active support of Putin. He loves this, right? He loves the destruction. He loves the pictures of the crazy people hoarding gas. There shouldn't be hoarding yet unless Colonial has their numbers wrong. I'm not worried. I filled up my cars and that was about it, but I don't drive much either. So
what is the correct response for the United States at this juncture?
So there's a couple things. I mean, the overt ones are, you know, the continuing sanctions, if not harsher, and now there'll just be more entities. Remember, the way to make it hurt for Putin is of course that the oligarchs and the rich people who are getting rich off of him become less so. They like to travel, so travel bans. They like to send their kids here, so travel bans against them and their kids, which I think is essential, will go far. And that's just sort of a squeezing of the neck. It's not going to end him. And then there's going to be the covert opportunities. We may never know what they are. They may just be signals that that the Russians certainly know what they are to say, get out of our systems. But ransomware more generally is a huge, huge scourge right now for the private sector. And because there's no laws against paying the ransom, so to speak, we have no transparency on what companies are doing. And then, the pain of the ransom begets more hostage taking. And so we're going to see this for a lot. And we've seen it you've heard about it in some municipal jurisdictions and others that someone gets into the system. But again, this to me is a 9/11 of cyber without
really
with yeah oh yeah there's you, folks,
I know nothing
I mean, this
and
is,
I am totally with you
yeah this
I am
is
totally
this is
you.
A this is a mo it's a moment of reckoning. I'm obviously the impact's not the same, but to the extent that we view a certain kind of threat this time a cyber attack, as being of such consequence to the U.S. capacity to run its networks and its supply chain. This is a huge wake up call, and the lack of focus on it. I mean, I think, you know, you're hearing people, but I think it's just because it's hard to feel right now. If we started to feel it, and if there's a week two or week three, we would view it as such. And so our response has to be strong. And I think we'll see some of it, and then we won't see some of it, which is fine by me.
We're talking to Juliette Kine. By the way, one of the things, I mean, she's the national security expert. One of the things the U.S. can do, and answer your question, Marjorie, is redirect one of those Chinese rockets right at like the vacation home. In any case, before we get to the Chinese rockets, we will. This is called
my favorite.
No, the goal is to get the listeners wanting more. And so as long as we hold that carrot out there,
that's right.
It will shock everyone that I have strong opinions about the Chinese rocket.
So do I. I don't know anything about it, but I have very strong, because I'm thinking of moving to the Indian Ocean, and I really don't want to. So, you know, I don't understand. This is almost like, I feel like a fool asking this question. Yeah. Governor and probably soon to be President DeSantis has said businesses may not require vaccination passports, for lack of a better expression. Now, that has caused Norwegian Cruise Lines, one of the biggest in the world, to say, well, we hope we don't have to do this. We may have to move our ports out of Florida because we have to do vaccination whatevers. So putting aside, I don't want to get into the politics of this because it's going to give me a headache. We talked about Liz Cheney for most of the first hour.
Okay.
Let's side with Governor Santis for a minute.
Yeah.
That we want to be let people be free. We don't want to force them to do things.
Yeah.
How can you run a cruise line in 2021 and 2022 without requiring people to be vaccinated? You can't, right?
You don't even need the regulations. I mean, as you know, and we talked about what I had written a couple weeks ago in The Atlantic on the last show. I mean, as you know, I am a big fan of this. I'm a big fan of the private sector putting the kind of what I call burdens, right? It's not punishment, but burdens on people who do not get vaccinated. Let me just take a quick step back because I was listening to your segment before. Access is a huge issue. Hesitancy is related to access. And so what's going on now is we got to get to communities that are either hesitant or lazy or some combination. Because I do think that the core anti-vaxxers, you know, is a huge proportion of the Fox Network viewing population, but not it's still between 13 and 15%. So we can get very, very high, not herd immunity, but we can get to a place of normal-ish, as I call it. And so that makes me super excited. But one way that we get there is we create, you know, the equivalent of a TSA pre-clearance line, which is the benefit of having been unburdened by a vaccine. And I like thinking of a vaccine as unburdening you. It's not a burden. It's unburdening to do all the things, is you get through the line quicker, that the world over in the fast line looks better than the long line at Logan of the burden, those who did not get a vaccine. So you're going to see these divisions. You're seeing them with colleges and universities, my university, Harvard University, going to a vaccine for students requirement.
About time.
I know. And then you see it with MLB having certain areas at least that are cheaper, right? Because they could put more people in it. Remember you can lower the price. And you're starting to see it with the cruise lines, which is and their calculation. This is the world I'm in now because I do a lot of advising on this. Their calculation is this, and I think they're right, which is, they are going to get more passengers, more visitors, more people willing to restart those activities with a vaccination requirement than they will lose people with a vaccination requirement. And this is why the next phase is going to be concerts. And you're hearing Broadway. Broadway is thinking of having a vaccination requirement because and this is all anecdotal, but just thinking about someone like me is going to a Broadway play, even though I'm out and about and I'm fully vaxxed, on top of my list? Have I even like looked at the possibility?
No.
Right. I mean, I'm getting comfortable with restaurants. We're all sort of slightly traumatized. We're learning, we're figuring out how to live our lives again. So, you know, I'm doing restaurants now and visits and whatever, and then maybe I'll do a bar and, you know, I've got my order of things I'm willing to do. But if you said everyone has to be vaccinated, actors, staff, and the audience, and you know, all of a sudden you're like, yeah, my calculation does change, because we you know, all this debate about what we can and can't do and whether the CDC is too far behind. And I get it. And I do think the CDC needs to pick up its pace.
They do.
Yeah. But part of the reason why people may be reluctant isn't because we're idiots or we're traumatized or whatever. It's because there's too many people not on board, right? Mm-hmm. We're reacting to the lack of it. So if you can get the private sector to push people to the unburdened world. Wow, it looks fun over there. I get to do cruises. I get to see plays. I, you know, get to do X, Y, and Z. That's another way of pushing towards whatever number we need to be at normal. And I like this idea. So I'm promoting it. I'm advising it. This is the future. And I really agree with it.
So I am obsessed about the schools. Front page story in the Globe today about the schools kind of here, you know, the vaccine has not been licensed, as we know. But it seems crazy to me by September, when we could have a license, to not say everybody's going to be vaccinated in the schools. Teachers, custodians, administrators, and kids.
Yeah. So the employees, I just got a briefing about Harvard because we're going to have it for our students. And obviously, I think most faculty would be vaccinated, but I think that I don't know what kind of rules there are about, you know, staff who might not want to and stuff, but definitely the students. Absolutely. I don't understand. I mean, I know why some schools won't do it, but remember, like, the UC system is there. That's a huge system, for example, in California. Now, once again, we have to focus on access, because clearly there's lots of people who want it, who don't think it's easy, or just, you know, want it to be easier. I was listening on the segment before. Yeah, go to their work, go to the bars, go to the football stadiums, you know, the partnership with the NFL. I love all of that, sort of make it more tactical. And then we'll get numbers like we saw yesterday in Massachusetts.
Okay.
No, that's just remarkable.
China? So China rocket?
I believe the expression in the radio business is it's time to pay off the T's. Is that
okay,
what they say in the radio business?
I've never heard that
now,
before.
Now, explain to me. China's position is the U.S. was just trashing us because they love trashing our space program. We're doing great. And the evidence that they were trashing us for no reason is that rocket, that 20-ton thing, ended up in the Indian Ocean hurting nobody. So assuming that's true.
Well, the fish probably got whacked.
Assuming that's true, for argument's sake, the only way that argument would make sense is if they were contending that they directed it to quote, land or crash into the Indian Ocean. This was just a crapshoot, right? The fact that it ended up, opposed to Cambridge, was a crapshoot, right?
It was a crapshoot. This was an uncontrolled accident or space debris. And look, there's lots of stuff in space right now. Space debris is like one of those like weird subjects that I'm like oddly like obsessed with. You know, the amount of crap up in the air.
There are thousands of things, right? Aren't there thousands?
But but this is not space debris. I want everyone to be clear on why I think that the Defense Department's reaction, NASA's reaction, is entirely appropriate. China designed, you got to put this in geopolitical perspective.
Sure,
they are in a battle with us for a space station. They are way far behind us. So they have
and
a
we
series,
won't let them on ours, by the way. Right.
So, okay. So we have a series of launches. They have, a series of launches of a design. It's a design feature that the rocket falls in an uncontrolled manner back to Earth. That was number one. Oof. What we experienced this weekend, there's 10 more behind it. It is so negligent. It is so crossing of the
10
fingers.
10 more that are already up there?
They're no, 10. Up. No. Because so they go up and then they release.
So they're still
it.
On the ground at the moment.
10 more.
Okay.
So the reason why the language of the Department of Defense is, you know, responsible space behavior, you know, is like, this is so irresponsible.
Responsible
it is
space.
It's a crossing
behavior.
Of the fingers. Now, the benefit is people like me who are slightly obsessed with stuff like that get 10 more opportunities to be, you know, to be slightly obsessed. But jokes aside, this is where you know, the approach to China, because this is not a space issue, it's a geopolitical issue, which is the superpower of China is also a negligent world power and a sloppy one. And however COVID started, one cannot argue China acted responsibly in those early days to curtail a global pandemic. I know there's a lot going on with the lab theory, which I'll set aside for now. And then now with space, right? So you have it with public health, global health, and now with space.
Okay,
so
wait a second. Can I get a cut right off here? Wait a second. Them.
And now here goes my Twitter feed because quickly, when I say this, I get like the
okay, Chinese, well, here's it's yeah. my turn. What did they call her last week in the Queen of Calm or
Queen
something?
Queen of Calm.
So wait
right.
a second. We only have a minute Queen left. Calm. Queen of Calm is telling us that there are 9 or 10 more of these rockets about to be launched
That's
from China,
said.
Which
well,
are going to well, land wherever they choose
right
to
here.
Land.
It's right why here in I'm Boston. Calm. It's why I come. Every day I wake up without a rocket falling on my head is a good
is another day,
day
right?
Like, exactly. You just every day you live, you know. Yeah, I didn't. You know, I survived the pandemic.
It only weighed 20 tons, so don't worry about.
You know what
it.
I want to talk about? Tons. You know what I want to talk about next week? What yeah. about space debris? I mean, we're yeah. polluting the. Yeah.
Have you not read about? By the way, she's yeah. not exaggerating. There are
we're
tens
polluting.
Of yeah. thousands yeah. of things so still orbiting that are.
Are we
going to
have any
and
rules?
And public sector.
Yeah.
You can't litter in outer space. Or are we going to have any littering? You get. Tickets, little spaceship, the Jetsons.
No, everybody's got to wear helmets. That's what I've been saying for years. That's the only way we can be safe.
Masks and helmets.
I want people ticketed in space, okay. Juliet. Could you work on that, please?
Well, one hopes that China takes a step back. But just to be clear, this was a design feature. This was not an accident. This wasn't debris.
That's swell.
But, you know, as I said, I wake up tomorrow without space, you know, without a rocket on my head. It's a good day.
It's a good day. Hey, before you go, though, in all seriousness, next week or the following week, let's talk about, educate us about the state of space debris.
Space debris.
Seriously, we'd love to talk about that.
It was one of my favorite meetings when I was in government. It's like one of those ones where you're sitting in and you're like, is this real?
Can't
and
wait.
Like, this is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's terrible. All floating around. I'm very upset about
and
this.
Jim and Marjorie helmets for the next GBH pledge. There's so many
better,
angles
better
on this.
Better than the fanny packs. I don't know. I will
that
feel like I succeeded.
Is true.
Great to
the
see you,
public
Juliet.
Public radio
Jim
fanny
still,
packs, man.
Jim still wears his, though,
oh,
every
maybe
day.
I do. Maybe
I'm
I don't.
Game. It's 2021.
See you later.
Okay, see you guys.
Juliet, thank you very much. Juliet Kayyem joins us every week. She's a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University, Kennedy School of Government, an analyst for Juliet, an analyst as well for CNN.
By the way, just
she's
before we leave
she's
this,
the queen of calm.
This, in all seriousness, they had no
it's
idea
terrible.
Where it was going to come down.
That's right.
And luckily
That's
it came
the Chinese
down in
rocket.
The ocean.
But the space debris is going to keep floating around.
Well, not all of it and not forever. I don't know nearly as much as Juliet does. I know a little bit about it. For the time being, it's going to keep going
okay.
around.
Okay, so
around.
We had to worry about the rocket
yes,
and space debris
we
as
do.
Well. Okay, coming up. Time for the United States to share its vaccine wealth with the rest of the world. Our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, is going to talk about vaccines for 12 to 15-year-olds. Are we going to vaccinate kids that are going to school? And a bunch more medical stuff. That's coming up on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Now that the FDA has expanded the emergency use authorization for Pfizer's vaccine to children aged 12 to 15, the next hurdle is to get authorization from the parents. Amid the anti-vaxxers, what will it take to convince parents to have their children vaccinated? Should school districts mandate vaccines? The answer is yes. If there is too much hesitancy about getting children vaccinated, will we ever be able to get on the other side of the pandemic? Joining us online for his take on this, the latest GOP conspiracy theory that Anthony Fauci is to blame for the pandemic and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. It's unbelievable. He is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine. That would be in New York City. Hello, Art Kaplan.
Hello.
So what do you think is going to happen? As Jim said, the FDA has authorized the Pfizer vaccine for kids 12 to 15. With these parents that are hesitant, with kids that are hesitant, how do you think this is going to straighten out?
Well, I'm going to be optimistic. First of all, I think younger people, 12 to 16, that new group that's probably going to get permission in a few days to be able to take the vaccine. I think they really understand how horrible the COVID outbreak was, the social isolation, staying out of school, not seeing their friends. And I think they're going to be more positive, maybe even than some of their parents. I think we might see a push to try and vaccinate because they don't want to go back to that again. And they want to get to school or camp, and vaccination helps. And I think that some of them may actually be a little more community-minded than some of their parents might have been. One thing I think we'll see is some instances where kids say, I want to get vaccinated, and parents say no.
Yeah, and by the way, I don't know if we said this to you last week. I think I read it since we spoke to you last. You know, amongst the parents, I know this pains Marjorie greatly, the much more resistant one is the mother, by a factor of 2.5 to 1 compared to the fathers. We're going to get to whether or not we discuss with you almost every week mandates. What's your sense of what schools are going to do come the fall for those age groups which have been authorized for use? Are they going to do a mandate there?
Well, I think they're not going to mandate for the schools unless we've got a licensed vaccine by then. That emergency use sort of situation is making the schools nervous, but I think they'll strongly suggest it, that it's better to come back vaccinated. I think the schools are going to open, presuming we don't have any kind of, you know, next wave, we'll be in pretty good shape by then. Then we're going to have to see what kind of outbreaks we get in the schools. Is it going to cause more of a problem? But I think we're going back. And I was going to say to Marjorie, the reason the moms are nervous, it's interesting, if you ask, they're worried about reproduction fertility. And again, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, there is no way they can impact fertility. They don't spread DNA around. They don't touch the gametes, the eggs in a young woman. They're not going to cause any harm to a fetus. But I think it's reproductive health that worries women. And is that going to damage my child, or for that matter, my son, in terms of reproduction? But I think it's bogus. I think it's something we just have to say. We know scientifically there's no way these vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, can do anything to reproductive capacity or fetal health.
Do you subscribe to the notion, by the way, that Fauci, who, as we learned in the last 24 hours, as I just said, he is responsible for personally creating the virus in the Wuhan lab at some undisclosed date? We'll get to that in a minute.
I think there's truth in that because there were time periods where I didn't know where he was.
Exactly. But that's not my question. We'll get to that in a minute. But he also said yesterday that he thought by the end of the year we'd have emergency use authorization for every age group starting with 6 months.
I agree with that.
You buy it. That's great.
I do think that's coming. And here's the deal one more time with this fantasy conspiracy thing about Fauci, which is so ridiculous. The Chinese have no ability to make that virus in their labs. Neither do we. I went to one of my fellow classmates from Brandeis, a guy named Drew Weissman, who was a number of years behind me, but is the world's authority on coronavirus and also came up with a solution to the spike protein thing that gave us the vaccines. He has told me again and again, they can't replicate the virus. It's too complicated. They don't know how to do it. And think of this. It's the world's worst weapon. If you make the darn thing in a lab and release it, it kills your own people and it kills your own troops. This idea that Fauci is in a bio lab or spending money with China to brew up this particular virus is nuts. It's just, I mean, we know it's nuts, but it has to be said, the biology doesn't bear it out. It's not something you can make.
Well,
it came from a bat, if people are wondering where it came from, not Fauci.
I want to get back to the schools in a minute because the front page of the Globe today sent me absolutely through the roof. But before we do, as long as we're talking about Fauci, here's sound from yesterday's back and forth. Senator Rand Paul seems to live to go after Anthony Fauci. I'm not clear why, since he's so popular with so many Americans. But in any case, here they are going back and forth over conspiracy theories involving Wuhan and the COVID-19 virus.
Government scientists like yourself who favor gain-of-function research.
I don't favor gain-of-function research in China. You are saying things that are not correct. I fully agree that you should investigate where the virus came from. But again, we have not funded gain-of-function research on this virus in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, no matter
you're
how
parsing
many times
words, you're parsing
you say
words,
it,
there
it
was
didn't
research.
Happen.
You know, Rand Paul.
By the way, Marjorie, that sounds like my average classroom. But go on.
What is gain-of-function, by the way? I don't even know what it is.
It
what
means
does it
you
mean?
Make the virus and then you add properties to it, like make it more infective or make it nastier.
Yeah. What is going on with Rand Paul? Do you have any idea, any insight into what the senator is after here?
By the way, there are rumors that Rand Paul was found with your former almost classmate Weissman walking around the back halls of Congress a few weeks ago when Anthony Fauci's whereabouts were. So what is going on with Dr. Rand Paul?
He needs gain-of-function research. He clearly has lost his marbles about this Wuhan virus thing. He is a doc, but I think what's going on with him is they want to get this link to China. They want to get this link to the NIH because they got a lot to answer for from mishandling the COVID pandemic last year. Somebody said there was an estimate out. I saw it on NPR. 900,000 maybe might be the top death rate, not even the 550 that we talk about. There's hundreds of thousands of preventable deaths there. Somebody's going to go back. You know, I've been screaming for a commission to go back and investigate who bungled this thing. And right at the center of it are Trump supporters, Trump appointees into the bureaucracy running science supervision. And Paul knows that. So I think that's got him desperate to point blame somewhere else.
So you talk about in this great piece you wrote for Barron's with one of your colleagues, talking about how you think that because of the coronavirus, that these approvals of these vaccines, licensing, the ones that make them, what's the correct terminology, Art Kaplan, please, are no longer emergency use. What are they?
License, right?
License, okay.
A biological license application would get them licensed.
Okay, and you think that's going to happen in a few months because...
I do.
Okay.
I do. Pfizer's already applied for it for theirs, so the wheel's turning.
I read this front page story in The Globe today where schools seem to be hemming and hawing over whether they're going to require vaccinations. The Needham superintendent was absolutely sure, said we will absolutely require vaccines for all students and staff once the shots are fully authorized by the FDA, you know, with few exceptions. I assume those are medical. I guess I don't understand why there's all this hemming and hawing from other school systems once the virus gets that licensing, when they require measles, mumps, rubella, when they require chickenpox, when they require these other childhood vaccinations. So is this politics again, or?
Yeah, it's politics. I mean, I can't really peel you off the roof on this because it is outrageous that they're saying a licensed vaccine approved for younger people would not be part of the regular vaccine mandate. Why wouldn't it? It's ridiculous.
Well, they're hemming and hawing. They're not
about the.
They're not
definitive.
You know,
we can fight about emergency use and whether you want to go now. I would. I'm okay with that. I think. To give the vaccine out to 150 plus million Americans, it's probably pretty safe, pretty good. I'm on board. But if you want to wait till licensure, you know, there are now 13 states that have passed legislation prohibiting mandates.
Really?
Yep. Arkansas, many of them. I mean, I hate to say it, but the usual suspect states. But the reality is, you know, those aren't even constitutional. I mean, you can't tell somebody you can't make your school or your workplace safer. It would never hold up to a court challenge, in my opinion. I'm no lawyer, but it's ridiculous not to mandate school vaccinations of licensed recommended vaccines, knowing that there are strains out there, knowing that the way to keep the schools open is the best weapon we've got is vaccination. It makes no sense to start, you know, saying we're not going to do it in the fall.
You know, one last thing on mandates, and then we'll move on. In your piece, in Barron's piece that Marjorie referenced.
By the way, let me point out that my dad would be very proud that I published something in Barron's. That's the last time I saw someone actually looking at Barron's in my immediate environment.
We did too. you also list a hypothetical grouping of the kinds of places, businesses, et cetera, that are likely to do vaccinations if you want to come in. Could you go over that quickly for us, if you would?
So look, the most obvious place are nursing homes and hospitals.
Amen.
That's where the outbreaks, the deaths have been the worst. I'm trying to urge my place to put in a mandate right now. NYU, we haven't done it. We're churning around this emergency use thing, and I think we should go. It makes sense. If you're a customs agent, I think you'd like to be vaccinated. That would make a lot of sense to me. ICE agents operating on the border, plus the people who are waiting, detained in these crowded conditions. Yep, vaccinate them. Prisons, prison guards, big outbreaks there. Ought to be vaccinating there. There is, thank goodness, one cruise line in Florida that basically said, we want to vaccinate as a condition of employment all our crew and staff. And that's one of the states with that brilliant Governor DeSantis who said, can't do that.
That's Norwegian. We just discussed that with Juliet Kyle a little while ago.
I think that's great. And I think they should take him to court and knock those ridiculous prohibitions aside. Of course they can make the workplace safer. What would be the argument prohibiting that?
You know,
make any sense.
But Art, one last thing about offices, just for a second, in terms of mandates. I had the acting mayor of Boston on TV with me last night, and she lines up with our governor, who doesn't believe that public-facing government employees should be mandated to be vaccinated. They should be urged, et cetera. Maura Healey, the attorney general, told us about a week or two ago, she does believe there should be a mandate. In private businesses, where there is physical interaction with the public, they should be on the mandatory list too, should they not, for the safety of the customer?
Well, look, we talk mandates till we're blue in the face here, but there's a strong mandate, you can't get out of it. Then there's a weak mandate, you might say, well, if we can accommodate you in the workplace, you can work from home, you can do that if you don't want to get vaccinated. Certainly we could do with a weak mandate. A lot of these companies have sales forces, they're delivering things to your house, water, food, Uber drivers. I'd like to know that my taxi or Uber driver or Subway employee or bus driver was vaccinated. I think that's the way to get commuters back onto the MTA and other public transportation systems. They're afraid to go now. So if you want to see them go broke, don't vaccinate.
But again, I just wonder how we can get around, particularly in schools, that you have to be mandated for all these other things, and we carve out this exception for COVID. It seems to make no legal sense, or certainly no thoughtful sense.
Well, here's the way it might make tiny sense. The mandates for going to school have really been kindergarten, first grade.
Yep.
The mandates for COVID are coming down the age groups, right? So we're at 12 to 15, and next we'll be going 2 to 12 probably. But until we get to the 2 to 12 crowd, somebody's going to say, well, you know, it's not part of the usual kid-approved mandated vaccines. But that's going to all shift. I know we'll have probably 6 or 7 times tell the listeners to look forward to this discussion yet again, but we'll get it by the fall. I'm pretty sure that everybody's going to be in a licensed vaccine requirement from age 2 up.
You know, one last thing about Fauci today, Art Kaplan. He said the other day that he thinks the CDC in the near future is going to come out with more liberal, even though the CDC has been very cautious in almost everything, I think overly cautious in a lot of things, new rules about being unmasked indoors if you are vaccinated. There was a very interesting discussion between John Berman on CNN the other day and the head of Health and Human Services, where the head of Health and Human Services, the secretary, really couldn't answer any questions about why vaccinated people should still be wearing masks, other than an abundance of caution, one of the most overused expressions during this whole thing. Why should fully vaccinated people be wearing masks when the goal seems to be to show the public the benefit of getting vaccinated so that those who aren't want to go get vaccinated themselves? If you still have to wear your mask, there's less of an incentive for the so-called hesitant. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, I mean, unless you're engaged in sort of mass sumo wrestling practice, you know, outdoors, I don't see much reason why we have to be masked outdoors. The data keeps coming in that that's not a major transmission route. A lot of people vaccinated, incidence of the virus way down. It's hard for me to see what the case is.
How about indoors, though?
Indoors, look, there are some people who can't be vaccinated. You're more likely to encounter them indoors, so I think you're trying to protect them. And remember, the vaccines are about 95% effective, but not 100%, so you might be cautious and say, I'm going to wear a mask. And some people are thinking, too, I still have a five-year-old at home. I don't want to bring it home. If you're indoors with me, let's mask so I don't risk giving something to my child. It's caution. It's all caution. I get it. You want a prediction? I do think in another month or two, they'll probably pull the mask requirement if we can get better vaccine distribution. If more people will vaccinate, I think they'll get to yanking the masks. Oh, by the way, having said that, and we can all put them back on next fall to prevent the flu. You know, there was no flu this year because everybody was messed up. So even if you take them off, don't throw them away.
Okay, hold on to them.
Yeah.
So apparently, and somewhat tragically, I guess, all across America, now that people are actually having to leave the house or wanting to leave the house because things are slowing down somewhat with coronavirus, they're going to get their pants and they're trying to put them on. And they don't fit. So this has resulted.
Marjorie, I told you that off the air. I didn't tell you to mention it on the air, but I guess it's too late now. Go ahead.
So
he hasn't been wearing pants until now, but go ahead. Yeah.
So there's been there is now a coast-to-coast diet craze in the United States of America.
What does it take to not have a diet craze in the United States of America? I mean, every week there's a diet craze. Of something or other. I was listening to something on the radio that said you could get more chlorophyll if you ate this like algae diet, which
was
getting promoted right now. It's called Sun Diet or something. It's like, chlorophyll? Are you a plant? What are you talking about? But anyway, I do think some of us gained some weight, although I think some people exercised more actually indoors. They got their equipment and did, you know, some indoor exercise. So
yeah, and their cat was killed by the Peloton. That's the only problem. And their kids were dragged under it. Other than that, it was great. They lost 3 pounds.
But, you know, what am I going to say? I'm going to say if you were locked up for 15 months indoors and you gained 5 pounds or 10 pounds, I get it. I'm not shaming, blaming, doing anything. It was stressful. Now the stress is starting to yield, get outside more. So hopefully, you know, just go back to your old diet and move around more. I think we'll be okay. But boy, we love those fad diets. I'm almost tempted to want to Google right now and see what my famous advisor on this matter, Ms. Paltrow, has to say about the right diet.
Oh, gosh.
You know, speaking of Ms. Paltrow, there are commercials. I mostly watch CNN, as people listen to the show know. Every other commercial is for Noom. And I can't tell you how many people I've encountered who gained weight during the last 12 months who said they're going to sign up for Noom. And then on my honor, in every case when I've said to them, what is Noom? You know what their answer is? I don't know. All I know is people say they lose weight on Noom.
One of our guests, who shall not be named, talked about losing like 15 pounds on Noom.
They did?
Yes.
Oh, I don't even
know
who that
is. She looks terrific.
What do they do?
I don't know.
I don't know what they do. I don't know. Maybe they get some prepared food or something like that. I have no idea.
But it has nothing to do with an egg, speaking of Gwyneth Paltrow. You know, Art, on a much more serious note, well, actually, weight is a serious note, before you leave, assisted suicide, or it depends, you know, death with dignity, everybody calls it something differently, apparently is about to become law in Germany, adding in a lot of the countries, obviously, in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. Do it. What I found, the only reason we bring it up, what I found most interesting about it is public support for it has grown dramatically in terms of polling during the pandemic. And it's pretty obvious to me that's because they've seen, you look around and you see so much suffering and death and loneliness and that sort of thing. So I guess another prediction asking for, and we've discussed it with you, obviously it lost 51-49 here several years ago on the ballot after leading, and then the Catholic Church spent a ton of dough and narrowly defeated the proposal. In your estimation, is the pandemic going to provide a boost to those efforts in the remaining states in the United States in the next year?
Yeah, I think so. By the way, the Germany case is very interesting.
Why?
Because of their history around euthanasia.
Oh, that's a very, very good point.
So when they move to say we're going to permit it or regulate it, it's major. It sends major reverberations around Europe, but even over to here. It means, you know, we think we can control things and we understand the history of, you know, genocide that so besmirched Germany in the past, but you know, not small potatoes when that country decides to do it. And yes, I do think the pandemic confronted many more people with death, dying, tough, miserable ways of dying. And I do think it's going to reinforce a push to make assisted dying, critics call it assisted suicide, but help with dying an option. It just seems to me the alternative is fix the nursing homes, make palliative care better. And I don't know what it's going to ever take to make nursing homes better. But if you don't do it, you drive people into the arms of saying, well, maybe I don't want to stay here then because I don't like the options.
Maybe the choice is to do both better, I guess, is the bottom line. Art Kaplan,
pleasure
as always.
Great to talk
thanks
to
for
you.
Your time.
And great to see you,
Art. Right,
I'm looking
go
good.
I'm going to go look for Tony Fauci now. So
wherever he is.
Okay. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's a Dr. William Meffin, Virginia Conley Media Chair, Professor and Founding Head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Thanks again to Art Kaplan. Coming up, a series of fatal shootings at the hands of police are raising questions about how police officers are trained. That conversation is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Mardrigan. Last month, police officer Kim Potter shot 20-year-old Dante right in the chest during a traffic stop. Potter, a 26-year veteran of the force and president of a police union, said she mistook her pistol for her taser. It's a mistake that seems improbable to anyone who is not in law enforcement. It's a mistake that is all the more disturbing considering Potter was training another officer when this happened. Just one example of several fatalities at the hands of police officers that has happened since Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder. This rash of incidents is raising all kinds of questions about the state of police training in the U.S. and what needs to change. Joining us for his take on what's working and what is not is Chuck Wexler. Chuck's the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. It's a nonprofit that studies policing, and he's a Boston Police alum. Chuck, really good to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be with my friends from Boston. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Great to have a Boston alum here, Chuck Wexler. So you argue, obviously, that training is a huge, big deal. So what do we need to fix? What's the top of the list?
Well, I think we have to rethink training. We've been doing that for quite some time. We came out with guidelines in 2016 on use of force. You know, whenever there's a police-involved shooting and the media calls, say, why did the police officer do what he or she did? We say usually the same thing. They did it because that was what their training said. Now, in that incident you spoke about in Brooklyn Center, clearly that officer made a huge mistake. We wrote guidelines for the Justice Department in 2005 on use of electronic control weapons, tasers, and said, specifically, the taser should be a different color, and it should be on your weak side. The fact that this officer was like a veteran, was a field training officer, only complicates it. So, I mean, training is at the heart, and rethinking training in a major way is important. The standards today on use of force are so different than they were because people are seeing these videos and they're asking one question, which is, why would the police do that?
You know, when you said, Chuck, that the standards are so different from what they used to be, they're also so different from each other. I read an interview with you the other day where you were talking about the fact, it never occurred to me, I guess it's obvious, what are there, 18,000 police forces and no national standard.
Right.
And so I would assume, particularly, as I'm not saying there aren't problems in big cities, obviously there are tons of them, but in smaller communities with smaller police forces that don't have the resources, without uniform standards, they never get away from being behind the eight ball, do they?
No, I mean, that's the problem. I mean, you've got, you know, body-worn videos, you know, now reaching most parts of the country. And the Washington Post, you know, looked at officer-involved shootings. There's 1,000 a year, 1,000. So that's about 3 occur a day. So, you know, we look at this routinely. We look at videos. We'll see them a day, and people say, why do we have this problem? And, you know, yeah, there are 18,000 police departments. Most of them are under 50. Most of them, you know, they're in silos. They don't know advancements in training. We're unlike, say, Germany or Israel or the United Kingdom that has national standards. But American policing is very personal. I mean, if you said in Massachusetts, I think you have over 300 cities and towns.
351, to be precise.
Yeah.
I guess it's been 51 since. Yeah. But anyhow, if you said today, we're going to consolidate these 351 towns and cities, you'd have a riot.
We know that.
Because people don't want that. Even in 2008, when you had the biggest recession, you said that would be the time to consolidate, regionalize. People were against it.
But you all, I also learned in preparation for talking to you today, Chuck, that other countries have people going to school, in some cases, to police universities. Right. They're not just going for a few weeks or a few months, right, or even going for a few years. So how did we arrive at the conclusion in the United States that police officers only needed minimal training in some cases? They talked about, in some cases, only 8 hours of training in how to de-escalate a intense situation. It's not much.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, these are all great questions. And I think we're, you know, people talk about reimagining policing and so forth. We really do have to think about what we want police to do. And, you know, look, when you're in crisis, when something bad is happening to you, there's nothing better than a good cop, and there's nothing worse than a bad, yeah, cop. And, you know, I also worry about, with all of the stories about policing in the last year, who's going to want to be a police officer? I mean, when something happens, the first question people are saying is, why isn't he charged with murder? Why isn't he arrested? Why isn't he fired? Would you want to take a job where if you did something, the first thing people would say? So, you know, there's that side of the equation. But, you know, there's a lot of good cops out there, and they get overshadowed by some of these videos that are so egregious that it's really hard to explain.
But how about that woman cop, the New York City police officer in Times Square just the other day? Oh, forgive me, I forget her name. But I saw her pick up that little baby that was shot with a tourniquet, run to the ambulance, and I was almost in tears. I mean, that was beautiful.
That was a great image of that woman officer grabbed the child who'd been shot and ran through Times Square. There's a lot of stories like that. We work with the emergency service unit of the NYPD. You know, those are the people who are on 9/11. They were running into the building.
Yep.
You know, lost about 25 of their people. They picked people off of bridges. And we actually adopted the training that the emergency service unit does, our ICAT training, to de-escalate situations. But it's a complicated business. And what's happening now nationally is you're seeing a significant drop in people who want to become cops, and they're retiring early. In like Portland, Oregon, you know, they're down significantly. Minneapolis, which had 750 officers, is now down to like 600. And crime is going up. Murder and shootings are going up. So it's a really important topic.
Let's return to training, though, Chuck Wexler. Chuck Wexler is the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. Give us the two or three things at the top of your list of those items that are not being adequately trained that, if they were, would change policing as we know it in the 2020s.
Well, I think a fundamental principle is, if you start out with this principle, the sanctity of human life, we developed guidelines in 2016. That was the number one. Why would we say that? Because the ultimate goal in these situations is for everybody to go home safely, right? For the police officer and the person they're dealing with. There are situations, I'd say 40% of the officer-involved shootings involve people in mental health crisis, shooting at cars, rocks, bricks, knives. We think we can impact that 40% with a change in thinking. Slowing things down, using time and distance and communication. When someone's in crisis, for example, if someone is in crisis and they're suicidal, the very worst thing you can do is aim a gun at them and scream at them. But yet that's what the police have been trained to do. If they see someone with a knife And they, you know, they know, they go, went to that location and they hear the words, they may be suicidal. That kind of training, which we now offer, says rather than rush in and confront the person with a gun, you step back, you find out information, you learn their name, and you slow things down.
Well, you know, let's stay on that just for a second. Bill Evans, the former Boston Police Commissioner before he went to BC, used to be a monthly guest on our show, and he talked about adding social workers, mental health experts to go with his cops to certain locations, which leads to the one of the things that sets people off in all kinds of directions, this so-called defund movement. Defund the police, as you well know, 99% of the people who say it don't mean defund the police department. What they mean is what they mean in Boston, your former place of work, which is divert some of the police budget to other things. So instead of training, you delegate. Let there be social workers. Let there be mental health experts. Let there be those kinds of things. Isn't that part of the so-called toolbox of things that would cause police to be more effective and less problematic in our communities?
Well, you know, look, I think there's opportunities here to collaborate with city agencies that are better at dealing with people in crisis. So that definitely should be on the table. The problem is timing. So many of these incidents happen in the middle of the night, and people call the police because they don't know who else to call. Yeah. So the police arrive. But if you had some kind of collaboration in which you learn the person's in crisis, the person may be suicidal, would it be great to have a social worker with you? Absolutely. The question, I guess, that, you know, when you think about police reform, the defund movement didn't help, you know, the police reform movement, because what people would think about is, wait a second, you know, we have to train police more. We have to give them body-worn cameras. We have to have more oversight. That all is an investment in police. So why would you think that at the moment you have to change police, taking resources away? I mean, they're different issues. If you want to provide social workers, that's great. But at the same time, you should be investing in police. You know, as Marjorie said, if you know, training is only, say, a few months, and it takes, say, a year to train someone. Or in Germany, believe it or not, they train people for 2.5 years. I'm not advocating that. But, you know, if you want to fix police, you know, you have to work at the front end. You have to work at the training and selection and all of those things.
Well, there was a great story in the Boston Globe today, our local paper here, about how efforts to look at who gets hired and to try to weed out people that may have been white supremacists or posted all this KKK kind of stuff, people that have kind of gone off the deep end should not get on the police department. Right. But then you run into First Amendment civil liberties issues, too. I mean, that does seem to be an issue you hear more and more about rather radical people joining police forces.
Well, that is an emerging issue. You know, when you select people to be police officers, it's not like a microcosm. You don't say, well, look, there's X number of extremists or racists, so we're going to have this number in the police department. You hold police officers to a higher standard. Now, in some ways, I know people aren't going to like this, but when you become a police officer, in some ways, it impacts your First Amendment rights. You don't have a right to say racist things. You don't have a right to affiliate with, you know, Proud Boys or things like this. You have to enforce the law. So the public and your department expects you to conduct yourself. And now the difference is you can't be on social media when you're off duty and somehow express racist thoughts and think that's not going to impact you. That's what's changed. That's a hard thing to get your head around, because Americans do want First Amendment rights. But as a police officer, when you're testifying in court and you're enforcing the law in an impartial way, there's a reasonable expectation that you're not, you know, engaging in some of these activities.
We're talking to Chuck Wexler. He's the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum. The other thing I was dying to ask you, so many times when you hear, I mean, Derek Chauvin was such an extreme case, you know, 9 minutes on George Floyd's neck. But when you see other cases that are a little bit more murky. So often, the police officer involved, it turns out, has a long record of excessive force.
Right.
And, you know, people talk about, well, these are a few bad apples, and I don't know right. how many bad apples there are. But it seems to be the problem. And Bill Evans, the commissioner, used to talk about this. You can't get rid of the bad apples because right. you try to fire them. You go to arbitration. They're reinstated right. by the union.
Reinstated by the arbitrator, not by the union.
Right. Reinstated by the right. arbitrator. But the union is on that side. Unions have got the right. police unions have got reform needs, it seems to me.
Right. No, everything you said, it is a frustration. It's something the public doesn't really understand. They look at Derek Chauvin. He had 19 or 20 different incidents and so forth. And in so many cities like Boston, Minneapolis, Chicago, Philadelphia, we have strong unions. You have these arbitrators that they have to be selected, you know, by both sides. And what they wind up is, you know, splitting the baby, making these decisions so someone doesn't get terminated. Or, you know, if they do get terminated, it gets overturned. It's a huge frustration. And it's something that, you know, people don't understand. They think that civilian oversight is a good thing. And in some cases it is. But in cases of discipline, one of the frustrations the police chiefs have is that they cannot terminate someone. They can't get rid of them. Because let's face it, you know, this notion of few bad apples, I don't subscribe that that's acceptable. I mean, you would never have an airline industry. You'd have a pilot and you say, well, there's a few bad pilots. You can't have bad pilots. You don't want to be on a plane with a bad pilot.
No.
You have 1,000, you know, airline pilots. And they say, well, we got a few bad pilots, so we're going to have to live with it. It's not an occupation. Or a doctor, you know, going, oh, this doctor, he took off the wrong leg. We got to really think differently about this.
You know, Chuck Wexler, when we started this conversation, we talked about how, quoting you, that training was not uniform because there's no national standard. I should know this. I'm embarrassed I don't. Does the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that's passed the House that is sitting in the Senate, does it address any of these national standards things? Or you're shaking your head, no, it doesn't.
Well, you don't want to paint a broad brush. There are some things in there that I think are good. I mean, one of the things that the police registry, like if you have a bad cop, you know, in Chelsea, he or she shouldn't be able to go to, you know, Duluth, Minnesota.
Absolutely,
and become
right.
a cop there, right? I mean, you know, but yet they let cops retire or resign and then, you know, there's no record. So that's good. But, you know, qualified immunity. I mean, I don't think cops wake up at night and go, do I have qualified immunity or not? You know, should I decide what I do? Some of those things seem good, but I wonder, will they change policing? That's what we want to ask ourselves. You know, banned chokehold. I don't have a problem with that, but you also have to worry about the unintended consequence when you spick something specific like that. Okay, cops can't do this anymore. What happens when they're in a situation where they're fighting and like in New York, they said you can't put your knee on someone's back or that'll be a misdemeanor. The unintended consequences of purposeful actions that result in police having to use more force or deadly force when we pick these items like this, all we're doing is sort of kind of addressing maybe what people think the issue is. The issues in policing are so much more complicated and they're so much more granular.
But I want to – chokeholds, for example. Massachusetts just banned them. I have to say I have not heard many people in your line of work say that that's a bad idea. I celebrated that. What did I miss?
Well, it's not that it's a bad idea, but it's like it's this – when you're thinking about use of force, you should think about all of the different ways you can approach situations and the unintended consequences of things. So it's not like I'm for chokeholds. I'm simply saying when you come up with that one thing that you should do, it has an impact on all of the other things. That's all I'm saying.
Got it.
I'm not advocating for it.
I want to return to one other thing we mentioned in the introduction, this whole taser issue. We have been talking about this on our various shows, Marjorie and I, probably for the 20 years we've been on the air. In a situation, let's go to, was it,
Micaiah Bryant, the young woman who had the knife, right, where the cop was in Columbus, Ohio, was pretty close.
Right.
There was pretty decent proximity. It wasn't like a – well, obviously she was holding a knife near another kid that was close. It seemed to me as a non-professional, the police officer was close enough to use a taser in that sort of situation. When I hear arguments, Chuck Wexler, that tasers can be lethal too, it makes me want to scream. Of course they can be lethal, but they're far less lethal than a gun. Why are tasers not used more by police officers?
So this is a longer conversation, but suffice to say, as I say, we've written the guidelines for the Justice Department 2005 and 2011 on tasers. I mean, tasers didn't have, when they were introduced, there were no, you know, there wasn't a user's manual. So people were getting tased right and left and they were dying. Amnesty International was, and so we developed guidelines. So I know, you know, quite a bit about them. They, you know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. 40% of the time, they don't work.
What does that mean, don't work? What do you mean?
They don't achieve the result of incapacitating people. You have these two prongs that have to go into someone. They both have to, go through all the clothing. They have to be a certain distance apart. And so we've looked at police departments across the country. So when they work, they're great. But that, you know, you don't always have that opportunity to use them. So sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. What we've seen is when officers get close and the tasers don't work, then they use deadly force. So, you know, it's not so simple as to say sometimes they work, sometimes they don't.
But isn't that, you're the training guy. Isn't that the whole purpose of training? To as best as one can, train young police officers about where they would be useful and where they would not be.
Right. Well, but they can't be looked at as a panacea.
Oh, I understand. I understand that.
What we say is always have a plan B. So if your plan is to use a taser and it doesn't work, what are you going to do? And one of the situations could be to back off completely. Mm-hmm. In that Columbus situation, that was really important to have that video. Because if there wasn't that video, if the Columbus, Ohio Police Department didn't release that video, people would say the police shot that person back. People could see one person had a knife and was approaching the other. And that was really, absolutely an interesting case study.
Well, you wrote something which I think is, we only have about a minute left, Chuck, but you said it's okay for police not to win. And that's really important to me anyway. Why is that important to you?
Because police are taught in the academy, look, you can't just walk away from something. But here's what I mean. If you go into a house because a mother says, my kid is out of control, he's upstairs in the room, he's got a knife, I'm afraid he's going to hurt himself. If you go into that house, you open the door and you put a gun on that kid and he starts approaching you, shooting him is like the last thing that mother wants. So when I say that statement, I said, it's okay for that cop to back out completely. Get out of that house. Have a plan B. That mother didn't call you to take the kid's life, but that happens.
Chuck Wexler, we really appreciate your time and hope you'll rejoin us again in the future. We'd love to continue talking.
Anytime. You guys, I love radio. I love Boston. You got me anytime.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you, Chuck.
Take care.
Chuck Wexler is the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum, a nonprofit that studies policing. Thanks again to Chuck for his time. Coming up, we look at the rise of misinformation, why it's increasingly easy for people to be misled and harder to overcome the falsehoods they're adhering to. The conversation is next with Dartmouth's Brendan Nyhan. You're listening to 89.7 GPH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. When people become susceptible to misinformation at the most harmless end of the spectrum, it could mean arguing with a friend who's been flirting with, I don't know, the flat earth movement. When people take misinformation literally and are inspired to act on it, things can become more dangerous and corrosive to our democracy. We saw this with, obviously, the shooting at Comet Ping Pong Pizza. Remember, that was the place where Hillary Clinton and her campaign manager theoretically had a child sex ring in the basement. More recently, on January 6th, with the attacks on the Capitol, There's the ongoing effort in Arizona to challenge election results. And today, the GOP voted to oust Liz Cheney in the House, they did, from her leadership position because she refuses to buy into Trump's big lie that the election was stolen. Brendan Nyhan has been researching the social and psychological forces that perpetuate misinformation, how widespread they are or not, and their impact. He's a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College and the co-founder of Brightline Watch. It's a watchdog group that monitors the status of American democracy. Remember American democracy?
I do.
Brendan Nyhan, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you for joining us, Brendan and I. We really appreciate it. So Jim and I talk a lot about this idea that misinformation is everywhere and that it's directly related to what happened today with Liz Cheney, to some vaccine hesitancy, to the toxic turn our culture has taken. So are we right about this or are we wrong about this?
Well, there's always been misinformation. So it's always important to start with that point that, you know, there was no golden age of truth in the past, right? We can go back and think of lots of examples from the mid 20th century or other times that people think that, you know, things were better. At the same time, there's a kind of partisan misinformation that seems more ubiquitous in this more polarized time that we live in, especially when political elites are promoting and amplifying those claims. So I worry the most about the misinformation that's been spread by elites and that is moving faster and further than it could in the past because of communications technology,
yep.
Right? That digital media makes it possible for this misinformation, right? Which we've always had. We've in every place, in every country, we've had it, right? But it, we have this political environment where partisan misinformation may be especially appealing to people given the way they think about politics, and then it may spread more quickly. And if elites take advantage of that, particularly to do things like attack the legitimacy of our democracy, that can be very dangerous.
But when you say partisanship, we'll get back to it in a second, we shouldn't dismiss the volume issue either. As you say, social media didn't always exist. Cable news stations didn't always exist. So apart from the partisanship of it all, the sheer volume of it changes the dynamic, does it not?
Probably. It's a hard question to answer because so much of the misinformation in the past was unrecorded in the ways that we would now observe it, right? So the word of mouth that happened or other kinds of ways that information transmitted in the past, we don't observe as much. I do think I worry about the volume in terms of the way that the internet can kind of function as a digital petri dish, right? Mm-hmm. Where the kind of most effective false information, the kind that propagates most effectively, can kind of bubble up from the digital grassroots. And then elites reach down or cable news shows reach down and pull that up and amplify it out. Right. I think that can be quite powerful. In the past, again, that might have taken weeks or months and it was a much less efficient process. I think now it can happen much more quickly. And we can see these stories, these viral stories move from the internet onto TV or into politicians' mouths within hours or days.
You know, speaking of misinformation, we may be, hearkening back to what Marjorie said to you at the top of this, Brendan Nyhan, we may be sources of misinformation. We read your piece you wrote in the Washington Post in November of 2020, Five Myths About Misinformation. Obviously, a lot has happened since. But the first of your five myths is most Americans dwell in online echo chambers. I am stunned by that, that they don't. I am one of the purveyors of what you consider to be misinformation. Convince me that I'm wrong, if you will.
Sure. So the first thing to remember is if you're hosting this show or listening to it, you're in the kind of an unusual set of Americans in terms of your media consumption habits. There are people who consume a lot of political news and follow the news very closely, but they're really a minority of people. And what happens when we look at behavioral measures of people's news consumption, what we see is most people don't pay very close attention to the news. And the people who do often have more balanced diets than we assume. It's really a relatively small subset of people who both consume a lot of political news and have a quite slanted news and information diet. With that said, that group is heavily overrepresented in two areas that might make them visible and salient to someone like you, someone, you know, who hosts a radio show. First is they're a big part of the news audience, right? Because mm-hmm. they follow political news so intensely. And second, they're quite visible and powerful in our political system because they're often the people who are most active in their party's bases, most likely to vote in primaries, write letters to the editor, and all of those things. So when we think about this echo chambers idea, I think it's important to distinguish between the average person who is just not following the news that closely or actually has a more mixed set of views than you might worry, and these kind of 5, 10, 15% of the public who are consuming news intensely and might have a much more slanted information.
I will take that as a kind rebuke, Brendan Nyhan, if I may.
Fair enough.
Well, you have a few interesting theories here, but before we get to some of those, Brendan Nyhan, tell us about what you just wrote about people with YouTube and Google. Google owns YouTube, and people going on YouTube and going down these, getting pushed down these rabbit holes.
Yeah, well, this builds on what we were just talking about in a really important way. You know, one thing that digital behavioral data of the sort that we're starting to get now in social science is allowing us to do is to distinguish between the kind of experience of the average person and the experience of these small but potentially worrisome minorities that have these more slanted experiences with what information they're consuming. So when it comes to YouTube, people have the same sort of concerns that YouTube is radicalizing millions of people. All these kinds of claims have been made, often about the kinds of news that's recommended to people on YouTube by its algorithm, right? So anyone who's used YouTube knows that it shows you a set of recommended videos to watch next, and it will even autoplay its top recommendation when your video's done. People have worried that may lead people down the kind of rabbit holes you're describing. We collected the kind of largest sample of people anyone's been able to do outside of the company, where we were able to observe their browsing behavior and see what videos they watched on YouTube. And what we found was the people watching extremist and potentially harmful content were a small minority, but the people who did consume that kind of content consumed often quite a lot of it. And importantly, they weren't primarily getting there via recommendations. The recommendation algorithm very rarely recommended these potentially harmful videos when people were watching other kinds of videos. The story that we found was much more consistent with the idea that actually people who had high levels of gender and racial resentment already that we measured in prior surveys were seeking out and consuming that kind of information on YouTube as well. So a small minority reaching this potentially harmful content. So very similar to the story we talked about before, which doesn't mean it's not worrisome. It's just a different problem. It's a different problem than the average person going on YouTube, you know, watching a cat video and spiraling off, right?
Yeah.
Instead, it's the person who has, you know, again, high levels of resentment. And now they're, unfortunately, it's easier for them to get connected to that content that might appeal to those resentments and even worse.
Well, Brendan Nyhan, you're all over this New York Times piece. It's talking about the social and psychological forces of the people that are prone to believing misinformation. Tell us a lot about that, because that's pretty fascinating. Who are these people?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that you can be vulnerable to misinformation. And the first thing I want to start with that's really important for everyone to remember is that when you ask who is vulnerable to misinformation, it's all of us, right? As human beings, we are all vulnerable to misinformation. We all make cognitive errors. Our memory fails us. There are all kinds of ways that we can fall victim to misinformation. One of the most salient, that's consistent with what we talked about before, of course, is our political affiliations. You know, in this polarized country, a lot of the misinformation we're going to encounter is going to appeal to one side's predispositions or the other. And so we worry about that as a kind of vulnerability, right, in our psychological defenses, right, that we may be too skeptical of information that contradicts our predispositions, including information that tells us that we're wrong about something. And we may be too accepting of information that seems to confirm the things that we want to be true. And so I worry that partisanship in particular has made us vulnerable to misinformation, and that the media and political elites may, in some cases, appeal to those vulnerabilities.
So when you write along those lines, we're talking to Brendan Nyhan from Dartmouth, in the end of that November piece in the Washington Post, the challenge is not that most people don't see the truth, it's that partisanship undermines accountability. So let's look at the figure we cite only about 400 times per show, that 70% of self-described Republicans believe the election was stolen. I don't know if this is a question that falls within your bailiwick or if it matters. Do they believe it, or do they just accept it because it's part of the partisan storytelling, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a really hard one to answer. One thing that we struggle with is even to say what a kind of true belief is. That it turns out to be a kind of deep philosophical question, right? If I ask you today whether you believe something and you say yes, and I ask you tomorrow and you say no, does that mean you were not telling me the truth on the first day, or did your mind change, right? Or is the way that I asked a question affecting how you respond? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of issues are tricky. With that said, I think it is true that, you know, people seem to be accepting of this false claim about the legitimacy of the 2020 election in a way that goes beyond the conclusion of that piece you're quoting from. Prior research found that lots of things that Trump claimed that were false, even his own base didn't believe, right? What the base was not taking him literally in the way the famous quote suggested. Yeah. But on this one, they do seem to be accepting it. One reason may be that the false claims about the legitimacy of the election are being reinforced by so many sources, right? It's not just Trump. It's so much of the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And that's why we're at such a dangerous moment in our democracy right now. That's why the Liz Cheney removal is symbolically so important. It's yet another a strike against the idea that, A, you can be a Republican and accept the legitimacy of the election, and B, that people are going to get information from recognized, accepted Republicans telling them that the election was correctly decided. Both of those trends are really worrisome because, of course, in 2024, we could be in this very same situation. And democracy depends on the losing side accepting the legitimacy of the result. The kinds of vulnerabilities and misinformation we've talked about, unfortunately, are a kind of weakness. Because if the losing side uses misinformation to deny that they actually were defeated, to reject the legitimacy of the winning side, right? Democracy can't long survive under those circumstances.
Well, you know, there was a lot written after the January 6th attack on the Capitol about who was there. And there were significant numbers of people who had big time financial problems. They'd gone through bankruptcy and lost jobs and stuff. That's certainly not all of them, but it was a certain number of people there, which feeds into this notion, correct me if I'm wrong, that there's this phrase is in this Times piece again, social destabilization, where your identity really matters hugely, and blaming other people for your problems matters hugely. And oftentimes that could be immigrants or Black Americans for your problems, so that you might be much more willing to believe misinformation to maintain that comfort in your circle.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have often thought that the misinformation and especially conspiracy theories specifically, right, may provide a way to help people counter that kind of threat to your status or standing. And they often, again, appeal to people's negative notions about outgroups, right, that my status is under threat or this event that happened that I don't like because of that outgroup, right? We saw, for instance, many of the false claims of voter fraud had clear racial overtones. They talked about cities with high Black populations, and it was often suggested that that's where the fraud was taking place. Now, these linkages aren't always as clear as you might think. Some of the folks who were arrested, if you read their bios, for instance, were quite prosperous, you know, small business owners and things like that. But it does seem to be the case that status threat and, it can be something that motivates people to believe in conspiracy theories.
You know, while we're talking about conspiracy theories, and I'm looking at you on Zoom, Brendan Nyhan, were you hired on the merits at Dartmouth, or was it to balance their guilt about having graduated Laura Ingraham? Do you have any idea where that – do you have any comment?
I have zero comments whatsoever.
Okay, fine. So maybe I'm making too much of a leap here, but so should we be worrying – and I mean the generic we – should we worry less – about misinformation, I don't mean to ignore it, and more about addressing the partisan approach to information, or are they so intertwined that the distinction is a waste of time?
No, I don't think it's a waste of time at all, actually. I think it's perfectly fine for partisans to interpret information differently. So the question is, though, can we have a kind of shared basis in facts to start the conversation with? right? So let's take an example. Think about climate change, right? The fact that the climate is changing due to human activities is real, and we need both sides to accept it. And there are some really important work being done by Republicans and conservatives to talk about the need for their side to accept that reality. Then, of course, what to do about climate change, those folks have different preferences than liberals might, right? And that's fine. That's normal, right? How you interpret those data and how you think about what policy solution is the right one, right? That's politics. Like, we should have that debate. It's just that when the underlying facts themselves become politicized, especially on such critical issues, that's when we're in trouble.
But when you may say the underlying issue, Bill McKibben's a fairly regular guest here, and he, I think, is the one that told us years ago that it was the Los Angeles Times that was the first newspaper in America to say we will no longer accept letters to the editor from climate deniers because there's no basis for the denial. It's sort of like the big lie in climate as opposed to the big lie in politics. Assuming that at least part of our attention has to be directed to addressing misinformation, I don't know if it's in your belly. What do we do about it? What are there structural changes that can be made in government? We talked the other day off the air, Marjorie and I, about now that Joe Biden controls the FCC, should the fairness doctrine be reinstituted? There's a lot of debate about that amongst people on both sides of the political spectrum. What do we do to address that part of the equation, the misinformation part of it, other than just being more intelligent consumers of information ourselves?
Yeah, that's an important point. You know, I'm always reluctant to blame people for being human beings, right? You know, it's great to say we should all fact check everything we read, but no one has time for that. We need institutions that serve us well and give us good information. So what can we do better? Well, you know, I think the media could do better to create incentives for people to provide accurate information.
What do you mean?
There to be reputational sanctions for people promoting misinformation. So removing climate deniers from the letters to the editor or not giving them equal weight in news reporting is one example. But for instance, not having people on who deny the legitimacy of the election is something that some people have advocated on political talk shows. Like, I think, you know, that's an example of the kind of reputational sanction that we have to consider. Because right now the incentives are backwards, of course, right? You can, you know, Donald Trump in part rode the birther lie to the White House. And many people, you know, use misinformation to raise their stature, to appeal to the base, to generate controversy that gets them on TV, right? So we've created a system that has exactly the opposite of the incentives we might hope. And, you know, I guess I don't think there's a simple policy solution, though, just to get back to your question. I don't think something like the Fairness Doctrine is realistic. I mean, for instance, that only applies to broadcast, right?
Of course,
which is an increasingly limited part of our communications flows. Even if we thought we could somehow reinstitute it, it would only apply to television, broadcast television and radio. You know, there's no, I guess there's no easy solution. And we have to learn to live with misinformation too. Let me just make one last point.
Yeah.
We have to say in a free society, there will always be misinformation. Our goal can't be to get rid of it, because the only way to get rid of misinformation is to eliminate the freedoms that we enjoy in this country. Right. The goal, you know, so the goal instead should be how can we reduce the damage that misinformation is doing to the stability of our democratic system, or the threat that it poses to public health during a pandemic, or the ability, our ability to respond to a global climate crisis? Those are the kinds of questions I think we should focus on and think about how we can do this while maintaining our values as a democratic society.
Yeah. One last thing for me, Brendan Nyhan, I say this all the time, so I'm going to run it by you. And Fox News, to me, is skews older. The audience is much older. There's a million stories about, you know, my dad, you know, my dad was a normal Republican, small government, low tax guy. He retires, and all of a sudden I go visit him. He's screaming at the television set, and he's talking about sanctuary cities and immigrants and all this kind of stuff. And that is an audience, as I said, that's older, that may not be surfing the internet as much as, you know, if you're 80, you're probably not doing it as much as somebody that's 30 or 40. So they are big spewers of misinformation. They do it all the time and constantly. So where do they fit into this whole mess? Because I think some people don't believe something could be on TV
and be untrue
if it was a lie. And I've heard this from my own family members who are very smart people.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, Fox has has moved more and more in this direction. I mean, there are still legitimate journalists there doing real news work. You know, Chris Wallace is widely respected, for instance, but primetime, especially the values that of primetime are not news values. And in fact, Fox defended itself in court against a lawsuit by saying no reasonable person would take what Tucker Carlson was saying on television to be fact. But I know that sounds like a joke, but you can actually Google it and find it. Online.
Sidney Powell is doing the same thing, by the way.
Fox's Trump's own lawyers are saying that, right? And you know, so when and Fox unfortunately is giving a platform to a lot of the worst misinformation, especially in primetime. We saw in the aftermath of the election, you know, a great deal of partisan misinformation, and again of the most harmful kind, right? Again, there's lots of misinformation that we should tolerate as the price of being in a free society. But misinformation that tells people you should not accept the result of this election is dangerous to our democracy. Like, that's really harmful. Tucker Carlson attacking the COVID-19 vaccines is really harmful. This is not just normal political misinformation. I don't like you. You're a bad person, whatever. This is really damaging to the social and political fabric. So I worry a lot about the turn that that they've taken. They're only doubling and tripling down on it. Tucker Carlson has an extra hour on their online platform. Mm-hmm. His segments are being pushed into daytime. They're making a more and more you know, Trumpified network, essentially. And that's pushing them towards this kind of misinformation and away from the kind of news gathering that used to at least be a part of their operation.
Well, the Fairness Doctrine would help that, wouldn't it?
I'm sorry?
The Fairness Doctrine would help
cable
that.
Is, but
it?
As cable. Brendan said, it's cable. So it wouldn't, unless it was rejiggered, wouldn't even apply.
Oh, well, I think we should rejigger and expand because there was no cable when we did it the last time, right? Now we have cable. Maybe we can get over there. Hey, Brendan.
And I, we really appreciate your time and your thoughts.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Brendan. Great stuff. Brendan Nyhan is a professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College and the co-founder of Bright Line Watch. Brendan Nyhan, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it. Coming up, the new Apple AirTag tracking device is heating up the debate about convenience versus privacy. We are taking your calls, asking which side are you on? That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Mardrigan. A couple of days ago, we were talking to Andy Inoko about Apple's new AirTag tracking device. It's the size of a quarter. Its battery gives it a lifespan of a year. And its function is to help you find something you're likely to misplace, attached to your keys, your wallet, in Marjorie's case, everything you own.
Uh-huh.
Thank you. And its sophisticated technology, I'm even laughing at myself, makes it pretty hard to lose anything. The downside, it's also hard to lose yourself. The Apple AirTag comes with a caveat. Stalkers can use it, too. All anyone who wants to keep tabs on you needs to do is drop an AirTag in your bag, attach one to your car, attach it to your bike, and that person can use their iPhone to track you, and you won't even know about it. We're opening the lines asking, does this concern you? It's sort of the classic, is the technology worth it if it means you can easily find your car keys, which is huge, or your pocketbook, but the flip side is your privacy, or worse, maybe sacrificed. Essentially, is this advance in technology worth it? 877-301-8970. We don't want to get involved in horror stories. We want to discuss the whole notion of colossal convenience. And Marjorie's not the only one for whom this would be useful.
I'm with him.
It'd be huge for me. But the flip side is there's a downside. And by the way, for those, don't waste time calling us if you're an Apple fan to say, well, every 3 hours or something, it chirps. So that you know that there's an AirTag on your bag or your car, whatever. What people who use that argument, I just saw it on Twitter last night, a lot of it, miss is if you have an Android like I do, it doesn't help you.
That's right. Well, that's why you have to get an Apple phone, Jim.
Well,
there's always some marketing in there, isn't there?
So you clearly are on the side. You'll take the risk of the downside because the upside, the convenience is huge,
I am not,
right?
You know, belittling people's fears about horrible situations domestic violence or stalking.
Well, but, obviously.
You know, I think you have to say to yourself, balance this out, Jim.
Yeah.
are you stock worthy? I don't really think I am. So you can do some so you can save endless hours in your life by being able to find your car keys, being able to find your phone, being able to find everything that you lose all the time, which a lot of us do. I mean, obviously there is a downside to this, but
yeah, I'd say so.
You got to figure it out. I mean, you just got to figure out what is
what matters to you.
Yeah, right. And the other thing I don't like about this is that you know, we've become hovering parents, and you know, people want to put
air tag their kids.
Yeah, they want to air tag their kids, and I think that's a terrible idea because
I would have put a chip in my kids if they had been born 15 years later. Forget about air tags. 877-301-8097. We don't want to be morbid in this discussion, but please don't tell us horrible stories. Talk generally. I have to say I'm with you. I say be as careful as you can be, but everybody listening to the show has lost something
exactly.
that mattered to
and
them.
When you think
and
about,
the notion that you can just tap on an icon and find everything that you're likely to use is like exaltation time for
me. You know, they've done studies about how much time at the end of the day when you're like, you know, how much time you waste standing in line, how much time you waste
looking for your keys. But
yeah, I mean, if you are a person that loses things, you know you're supposed to put them back in the same place all the time, and then you don't, and then you lose them. So if you're a person that loses things all the time, when you think about the time every day you spend looking for stuff, I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer.
877-301-8970. Is it a no-brainer for you? I love the invention. By the way, it's not the first one. What are they called? Tile, I think, has a similar sort of product. And Apple, you know, says they're really concerned about your privacy. And they do address it with this chirp thing. But it's from what I read, it not only is it of limited protection, but as I say, if you've got an Android, as I do, you have absolutely no protection from it. So we'll get to your calls, 877-301-8970, as soon as a couple of people are screened in about 15, 20 seconds.
Do you have one of those find your phone things?
No.
I mean, those are great. Those are great. I mean, like, the amount of time, because I lose my phone
I know,
all the time,
right,
and you just do your little thing in your iPad, assuming you can find your iPod. Yeah, but that's bigger and it's harder to lose.
It's harder to lose.
You just put that little find your phone thing and it chirps and it's like it's been heaven. You know what it's great about it? Even tell you, if it's a few blocks away from your house, I once dropped my phone in the parking lot when
that's
I got out
shocking.
Of the car.
Really
and
shocking.
About four, it told me exactly where my phone was. Thank God nobody ran it over. It was in a parking lot about 4 or 5
yeah,
blocks
but I,
away.
Can I say that most of the years I've known you, most of the things that you have, quote, lost are in your hand. Is we've I mean, I don't mean that as an insult. That is true, as you well know. So rather than having one of these air tags, just look in your hand or look in your head and or your pocket. Sheila Natick, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Which side are you on here, Sheila? Hi.
Well, did I miss you just starting to talk about the tile?
Yes.
Oh, crumb.
No.
You do it.
You
I just mentioned it in passing. Go ahead.
Well, a couple of years ago, my son-in-law was thrilled to be able to find a great Christmas gift for me. So he and my daughter gave me a tile, and it has literally saved me literally hours. It's wonderful, and it is not online where everybody can see it, I don't think. It is Bluetooth connected, and you can connect with a community, but you don't have to. And so I from being in the house to once I was at a doctor's office and I dropped my phone in the wastebasket where I never would have, never would have.
In the wastebasket.
Yeah.
I would do that.
Yeah.
Yep. I pulled I had my phone. I'm pulling out a paper towel and it must have slipped out of my armpit where I was having it all.
Well, let me make a suggestion, Sheila. I'm going to give you a little practical advice because you sound like a nice person. Don't put your phone in your armpit. I mean, that is generally my rule of thumb. Is that something you can live with or no?
No, I don't think so. Marjorie, do you know what I'm talking about?
I absolutely know what you're
talking
about. Of course she
does.
Yeah, it's a terrible problem. And, you know, everybody gives you a million tips on how to avoid losing things. And the problem is you forget to use the tips and then you lose them anyway.
Sheila, thank you.
You know what the real thing is?
A lot.
You're not paying attention to where you put things.
Yeah, but can I tell you something? We discuss this all the time. I mean, this is not totally related. Marjorie, again, I don't want to be unkind. Is it fair to say that at least 50% of the time you come to work at Guest Street, you forgot half of the stuff that was your prep. Is that a fair?
Well, I did today.
Okay. How many years have I been telling you the foolproof gimmick, which precludes the possibility?
You put it at the top of the stairs.
You put it at the top of the stairs so you would trip over it. to leave your house. You can't leave your house.
Yes, that
so
is
what
correct.
Do you do? Step over
no,
it?
No, but the issue is to remember to put it at the top of the stairs.
Oh.
That is the issue. Like to remember where you put your phone down. I mean, it's paying attention, and I think I neglect to pay attention. But
how many times your phone ended up in the garbage can like the first caller? Truthfully.
Only once in the garbage can.
Where
but
else?
Well, the refrigerator is a very common.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. You left it in the refrigerator. And I know this is a ridiculous question, but why would it have been put in the refrigerator to begin with?
I don't know.
You don't know. Okay, fair. That's fine. Alan Rode, I guess, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about air tags, the good and the bad. Hi there.
How you doing, guys?
Good.
It's funny. I got a notification today on my phone that I've called my wife's phone so she can find it more times than all my other calls combined.
Exactly.
That is a good one, Al.
You and I are in the same boat, Al.
So two quick points,
yeah.
If I could.
Sure.
She had a tile and lost it. That's the predecessor to this. And my kids, I hid their iPads the other day because they weren't doing what they were told. I hid them so they couldn't use them. I left the house. They used their Find My iPhone and found them while I was out.
Well, two great, great stories, Al. Thanks. Three great stories, actually. Thanks for sharing them.
You know what else about the AirTags? The batteries last like for about a year. Don't
no,
they say?
That's what
that's
the
problem,
Andy
too. My
us.
Kids got me one of those things to find things, you know, but of course the batteries last like about 3 weeks or something like that. So then it was, you know, the battery was dead and did you absolutely no good. Judy from Reading, thank you for calling.
Hi, Judy. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
I went on a hike in the White Mountains that doesn't have particularly great reception for, cell service. And when we were done the hike and in the parking lot getting into my cars, my husband calls me and he says, so how was the hike? And I said, how did you know? And he said, because I just hit find your iPhone and I know you're in the parking lot.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. How far away? How far away was he? How many?
He was 100 miles.
Well, it doesn't matter where he was.
100 miles.
Well, it's because it's through your
phone.
Yeah, go ahead.
He just used the iPhone.
Sure. Right. It's not an AirTag thing in that case. It's just the tracker in the phone. Now, Judy, you sound like a relatively normal person. How many times have you left your phone in the refrigerator?
Not in the fridge, but I dropped it in a fish tank once.
Oh, okay.
Luckily, I was fortunate enough to work at a vocational high school, and I sent it down to electronics, and it was fixed before my husband even knew.
Well, you know but what I do? You know what the solution to dropping your phone in a fish tank is? Carry 10 or 20 pounds of rice around with you at all times. Judy, thank you so much for your call.
Does that still work? That was the old solution.
I don't know if it ever worked.
I have heard people say that they put the phone in a bag of rice, and it did.
Yeah.
They had to wait several days for that. Robert knows you well, Jim. He says you're sticking with your Androids and no one can track your questionable slithering.
Maybe so. Speaking of Android, Marjorie told me during the break, this is actually very sweet, warning me that when next winter comes, I should avoid show snuffling. And I just want to say, thanks to Marjorie, and it means a lot to me. She said I intend to snuffle no show next winter when it starts.
You know, as I always say,
coming down.
It's amazing I'm on the radio, really, when you think about it, since I can't talk very well.
We're talking about air tags, and the beauty of them is you can find virtually anything. This is an Apple product. The battery lasts for a year. You attach it to your bike, to your phone, to your keys, whatever. The bad news is people can track you, too, which matters more to you, protecting your privacy and your safety. Or your convenience. And I'm guessing almost everybody opts for the convenience thing.
Carol from Lexington, thank you for calling.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, great. I have to say I'm a longtime Android user.
Yeah.
I've been using a Tile for some time because I'm always apt to lose my purse, my keys, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm interested in the AirTag for a different reason.
Why is that?
I don't want to be considered a helicopter parent, but I am the mother of a special needs daughter. She's on the autism spectrum, and she is minimally verbal. And the idea of her getting lost or wandering.
Yeah. Oh, that's huge.
Well, that's
panic.
You're in a different category, Carol.
Any parent
absolutely
who wouldn't do it in that circumstance, I couldn't agree with you more. It's terrific and incredibly valuable in that context. So I, you know,
yeah, that's a different. That is a whole different story. I'm talking
support,
about, you know,
Carol.
I mean, Carol, if you have a bunch of mothers get together and everybody but you is tracking their kids all over town, you feel like you're negligent.
Well, I told you the story. Did I tell you on the air a couple of weeks ago? Mm-hmm. And if I did, my apologies for repeating it.
Yeah.
One of our coworkers, who shall remain unnamed.
Oh, this is a great story.
Was her kid on one of those tracking things. And by the way, the kid, I'm 99% sure, knew. It wasn't like she was, you know, spying on him. And he got his license and she said, driver's license, you know, what are you going to do on your first day? I'm just driving around school, around the parking lot at school. And so she hit the tracker thing. He was at the Capitol Grill in Burlington. So, but he did, in fairness.
And wasn't he up having a clam roll in Maine one time?
Well,
too?
Oh, yes, actually, I totally forgot about that.
That was great.
By the way, he's a fabulous kid, but we won't say who he is, but he's a great kid. And he just likes good food, I guess. Krista and Haverhill. Oh, we only have 45 seconds, and it's yours, Crystal. Go. Krista, sorry.
Hi, this is Krista. That's all right. No, Marjorie, you know what? I have left my phone in the fridge so many times.
Exactly.
More so when I was actively drinking. So, but still, it occurs. I get it. You know what? These things make me kind of wary. And the reason is I watch a lot of Dateline. I watch a lot of The Blacklist.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of seems intriguing. Like, even I feel like it might be kind of fun to track somebody. And I'm of kind of sound mind. So when I think of all the people that do have these kind of scary relationships, or who knows? I don't know. I'm not 100%. I had the tile. I never activated it. But I'm also, you know, I don't lose stuff all the time. So maybe it could be helpful. But I am wary.
Yeah,
Krista,
well,
that was a great call.
Reason.
Call
there
us when we have more time another day. Thank you for joining in here. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I can see how people might be cautious. But
not you.
Not me. I'm ready to take the plunge, Jim.
Yes, you are.
Anyway, we are done for today. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by Chuck Todd from NBC, Paul Revel, our education man, and media maven Sue O'Connell. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubley, Aidan Conley, and Mackenzie Farkas. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker, and our offsite engineers are Miles Smith and Dave Goldstein. What's on TV, Jim?
Well, two things that I know you're going to be very interested in. Patrick Radden-Key from The New Yorker wrote that great book about Northern Ireland
a couple of
years ago. We had him on. He's written a new book called Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. They're the people behind OxyContin. You thought this was bad. Wait till you read this book or listen to him tonight. And I assume people read Shirley Leung's piece the other day about CEO pay in Massachusetts and around the country and the inequity, the disparities between CEO pay and worker pay exploding. Well, she will be joined tonight by Robert Posen from MIT, who's the author of the book Remote Inc., How to Thrive at Work Wherever You Are on CEO Pay. So we're going to talk about the explosion of CEO pay and what it does to our society. That's tonight at 7 o'clock.
You know what really killed me about that story?
Yeah.
Not just that they got huge pay, but that they had laid off tens of thousands of workers.
And the business lost money in many cases that year. So they're rewarded, I would argue, in some cases for failure, even though layoffs, I guess, are considered successes by some boards of directors. In any case, that's tonight at 7.
Okay, I'm Marjorie Egan.
Okay, yourself. I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you have a great day and hope you can tune in again tomorrow. Bye.